Hey, State of Games listeners, future Jessica here. I just wanted to jump in and let you know that due to some audio recording issues, which were entirely Daryl's fault, we had to post the Skype recording of this episode of the State of Games podcast, so I really want to apologize for the difference in the sound quality. Also, since the guys of the podcast don't mention this until about 30 minutes into the show, I wanted to let you guys know that I am actually not on this edition of the podcast. Due to some scheduling issues, and so that you wouldn't miss out on Daryl again, I actually had to miss this one. But it's totally fine because the topic is all about art and board games, and other than saying how blown away I am by the amazing artistic talent I've seen in board games in just my 1 year of gaming, I really wouldn't know what else to say. But to no one's surprise, the guys have plenty to say. So sit back and please enjoy this episode of the podcast all about art in board games.
All right, welcome to the State of Games. I'm Dice Hate Me.
I'm Get Louder.
I'm Puppy Shogun.
And we are a podcast all about anything and everything related to board and card games. So welcome to episode 114, or as we like to call it, the one about board games is art, and all that artsy-fartsy stick-up-your-butt poetry slam feelings.
Yeah.
Yeah, snapping. There will be no snapping on this podcast. I find that offensive.
Find that offensive.
Get your racist snapping out of here.
That's right. Get out of here. I'd like to warn everyone that the show notes this week were written by none other than TC Petty, so whatever I'm saying, and it doesn't sound like me, is going to sound like TC. That's because he wrote them.
You're welcome. By the time this episode's over, you're all going to feel like you just OD'd on Benadryl.
So that's right. Pour yourself a glass of red wine, get out your cigarette holders and maroon berets. No snapping, though. We have decided to class up this joint for one episode at least and talk about whether these crazy board games we love are just cool stuff or simply Dadaist reflections of societal standards through a postmodernist lens of consumerism and false incentivization for unethical actions which we indulgently assume control over. That
yes,
is definitely.
That was great.
That is a total TC sentence right there.
That was a good delivery, too. That was fast and southern.
So it's time to get artsy fartsy, people. But before we get on to that, what has everyone been up to this week?
Oh, man, I'm going to start because my name's TC and it's first on the list. My Japanese CCG experience has continued, and I'm still learning more stuff about them. But before I got to that point, I actually bought some Japanese CCG cards. So, yeah, I'm back into CCGs now.
Oh, nice.
Because it's the hipster thing to do.
You've come full circle.
Yep. Apparently Hasbro has a new CCG out that, like,
Hasbro?
I'm supposed to play next week or this week or sometime. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't even know what it is, but it's based on some sort of Japanese property again. It has coin flipping.
Coin flipping? Oh, they're stealing from you.
I know. But, however, I played Luck and Logic, which I'm finding to be really, I don't know, really fun. Like I said before, is like I really enjoy the fact that there's like different zones for the cards, and the way that you play the game can pretty much be ignore the text on the cards, except for like the big powerful cards. Other than that, you just pretty much go, and the mechanics support the game pretty well. So I really like how that works. It warms my Eurogame heart.
And what's it called?
And the other thing,
Luck and Logic.
Luck and Logic, yeah.
Interesting.
So, you probably haven't heard of it.
No, I have not heard of it. It's very hipster of you.
Yeah. So, and hey, you know, for everybody that likes that, like all the characters are women in it. So, the other thing I did, because I haven't really, my board game group has kind of not met for the last 2 weeks, so I haven't really got a chance to play some games, but I played Inside, which was a video game by the people who made Limbo. So this is like a supremely, another one of those indie games, but like, I think it's like Swedish or like Norwegian or something like that. I don't know. But it came with a warning that it was like, it or not a warning. it came that it was sponsored by like some arts society of
a country. So it goes along with our topic this week.
That's why I wanted to bring it up, because Inside was absolutely fantastic. It's like, for it is right across, right up your alley, Chris. We because I think all of us, Daryl, have you watched Stranger Things now?
God, yes.
Oh yeah. So okay. So everybody's watched Stranger Things. Even I did, which is weird. And
yeah, that's why it's weird you asking me that.
No, I didn't know. You know. But I thought Stranger Things was fantastic. I thought it was really good. I was into it within 5 minutes. And Inside has the graphic design of like a heist and a noir, I guess. So that noir feel, and the actual art of it is just, it's a side-scrolling video game where you just never stop side-scrolling. There's no levels. It's one big level. Oh, and wow. So it like just keeps going and going and going. And the plot of it is just, you're this little kid and you're running through the forest. And I got that, like the Stranger Things in my head, because it was like, these guys are out to get you in the forest. And you're like, why are they out to get me? Right. And the, I guess the crux of it is that you think you're running away, but you're actually running to something. Mm. So instead of running away from these bad guys, you're trying to get back to whatever it is that happened. And I won't spoil what it is, but I will say that the last 2 hours of this game, which I guess the game was like 5-6 hours, something like that. The last 2 hours of the game was absolutely blow your mind amazing. Like I don't know how, it's kind of like it, the only thing I could compare it to is kind of the ending of Akira, but for like hours and hours.
Wow.
And so I, oh my God. And I won't like spoil it, because that's all I'm going to say to spoil it. But I think like Chris, you would just, both of you guys would eat up this game. It is,
what did you, would you play it on PlayStation?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'll have to buy it then. How much is it, like, how much is it?
$20, something like that.
Yeah. All right.
So but it's like 6 hours and it's like self-contained. It's,
absolutely. So the ending is like, you said the ending is like, well, not like, but reminds you of like the ending of Akira?
Yeah.
So it's just like the last 2 hours, you're just yelling the main character's name?
Tetsuo! That's what, over and over that's again. What I was just hearing in my head when he said that.
Tetsuo! No. More blobby. Anyway, that's all I'll say. And it was, threw me for a loop, and it changed the game. It took the game from like, it was just all of a sudden a twist, and the twist just took the game to like a height that I've never experienced in games before. And it was just, for the last hour and a half, 2 hours, it was just going like jaw dropped watching the screen and what's going on. It was amazing. So yeah. If you love the futility of existence and like humans trying to get involved in that, yeah.
I've become very existential of late, so I'm sure I will really enjoy it.
Oh my God. And oh, also, if you like no question, nothing ever getting answered, you'll also like this too.
Well, I was a big fan of Lost, so
yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
There we go. So here's the thing. Okay, look, just this is going to be a little bit of a tangent, but that's the problem that I have with most people, is like they don't just enjoy the mystery of something. They got to have answers to everything, and I'm like, that is so boring. It is. Well, it's like
no, it's true. This game is, it provides that feeling of just like, what just happened, and
Well, I'll probably check it out then.
Hey, yeah, if you like, it's only a few hours. I mean, most of it's a puzzle-y game, so like some of the puzzles are great, but like the puzzles are just, they're not super hard. They're just like really satisfying to complete. I don't know how you do that, it's gorgeous too.
That sounds awesome. It sounds right up my alley.
They're really dark. I thought it was like, it was a little kid. I thought it would be like really like kind of uplifting or like do something, but man, it's just dark.
Well, that's really, I mean, that's when you talk about Stranger Things, it is dark. I mean,
yeah, like the threat of death is a definitely like a thing, so
that's cool. I'll have to check it out. So speaking of puzzly things, I went to Charlotte this weekend to hang out with my buddies that I've known my entire life. All of, let's see, Scott, I've known for 31 years. Steven, I've known for 41 and a half years. We were actually in cribs beside each other at our local nursery. So anyway, I went there, and Brian is his brother, so I've known Brian about as long. Anyway, we got a Groupon for an escape room in Hickory, North Carolina. And so we just, every now and then, we try to get together like maybe twice a year and reconnect, have reunions, and of course, it's like we're back in high school. But we went to Jigscape in Hickory, North Carolina, and we did an escape room called The Gas Chamber. And what we, yeah, ooh, it is dark. It's like you have an hour to escape or you're going to get gassed. And the room was all in black light. So all the, there was like, you know, neon paint on the walls with like words and cryptic descriptions of things and handprints. And then there were little jars of vials of glow in the dark liquid. And some of them had like human teeth and eyeballs and hair in them and stuff like that. So it really was kind of, I mean, it, I'm making it more glamorous than it really was. It was literally like something we would have put together in high school. Because it was like dumpster diving for all the different parts in the room. And I don't know how much I can talk about it because I don't want to spoil it for in case somebody out there is listening and wants to go to Jigscape. And I'm sure Jigscape would not appreciate me giving away their secrets. But I will say that we managed to break the game. And that was cool. We actually skipped five steps in the entire puzzle and solved the puzzle without doing five of the steps in the puzzle. And the creator had no, he was like, well, what happened here? You know, and we said, well, there's a crack here. And we saw that there was a piece of paper in it and we could see in. So we did that. And he's like, I've never seen somebody do that before. And I said, well, okay. I felt accomplished because we we cheated. We basically pulled a Kobayashi Maru is what we did. But
did you get out in record time?
No, it wasn't record time because it was still a difficult puzzle. And the main portion of the puzzle, it's a cipher puzzle, really. I mean, most of the room, there's a couple of physical things you have to do, but most of it's figuring out ciphers. The problem was is that there was no clue as to how to use the cipher other than setting the cipher up. And so we actually managed to skip the cipher entirely and skip like five steps and get in the middle of it. And we still used the cipher to decrypt what the numbers meant, which was fine. But beyond that, we finally got into the final cabinet, and then something else that happened, and then we found a note, and it led us out. But anyway, it was kind of fun because we pulled a Kobayashi Maru, and it was still a hard puzzle to begin with, even without doing the five steps. So I have no idea how people solve it without skipping half of it like we did. But anyway, it was fun, too, because not only do we do an escape room, I also got a chance to hang out with – we were at Steven's house, so we were with Steven's family, and I took Coconuts over there, which we played before. They always have a blast with Coconuts. The kids love it. But we also played, and TC chimed in on my my tweet about this game, Mystery Mansion, which is one of our 80s games that we all remember as kids. It was Scott's favorite game. I used to play it with him and his sister in middle school, and – basically, Mystery Mansion is like Mansions of Madness without the Cthulhu parts. It's basically...
No, just exploring a mansion.
Just exploring a mansion. But you're going in, and you have cards in your hands that are search cards, and you've got to try to search different parts in different rooms. If there's, like, for instance, you've got a card in your hand that has a plant and a portrait on it. If you're in a room that has a plant or a portrait, then you can play the search card, then you draw a clue card. Majority of the clue cards are cobwebs, which are nothing, but some of them might reveal a treasure chest or various other things that you can do. But the overall goal of the game is to find treasure chests, and take them out of the mansion and open them up and see if they have either cobwebs inside or treasure. And if you find the ones that have treasure first, then you win the game. Totally random. I mean, it's a very, very random game. But
I was just, and by the way, I was just kidding because I thought it would be funny. I thought it would be funny if someone said that, you know, these games from the 80s suck because there's no reason to state that. They all kind of do,
but they're still fun. I mean,
yeah.
And it's kind of ridiculous. You're right, because thinking about it with the modern sensibilities that we have now, it's like you think, how did this even exist? Because it was like, the evolution of board games since then has been pretty miraculous, and the concept behind Mystery Mansion is awesome. And when you're playing it, you're having a great time because we were all just having a blast, just, you know, reliving our inner children, you know, playing this game. But it's like, with like three or four tweaks to the game, I think it could probably be pretty viable in today's market. It's a cool concept, and the way the mansion is built out, you know, as you play along, you've got, you know, going upstairs and downstairs and all kinds of weird eccentric rooms and crazy things that can happen. And even during certain parts of the game, it goes like one of the search cards or the clue cards is like, a mysterious shadow appears before you. And before you know it, you're in another room, and boom, you know, it's like, it's just weird. So as kids, though, it's like your imagination could run wild. So Scott has two kids of his own, and I had to get back home, but I would have stayed and played with them. But when I dropped Scott back off at his house, I left Mystery Mansion with him, and he played it with his kids. And he showed me some pictures. They're on Twitter now, and they just loved it. They ate it up. So board games are cool because kids can have fun no matter what you're doing, but that type of game is like built for like the elementary and middle school age range. They just eat it alive. So we had a good time with that. And, mm-hmm. and speaking of modern board gaming sensibilities, I introduced them to No Thanks. And, of course, as we all know, No Thanks is one of the most elegant card game designs ever. It's a great, great game. And they, halfway through the game, they just, all of them just said, like, this game is awesome. And I was like, yeah, right? I mean, it only has cards and chips, and it's just really an amazing game. We also played Concept, which they had a good time with. It was a little bit different. Concept is visual charades, pretty much. Using iconography. Cult Express, which for those of you out there who haven't played Cult Express, is a programmed movement game. And, of course, it's always crazy, you know, as far as like where your programming movements are. And I punched every time. I don't think I've ever actually connected a punch in that game because I punched like three times in the game. And every single time, the person I was trying to punch was already gone. So, and then the one time, I was in the locomotive, and the lockbox was there, and somebody had picked up the lockbox, and I was standing right next to them at the beginning of the next round, and I didn't draw the punch card. I was like, I went first, too. I went first, and I was right next to the dude with the loot box, the lockbox, and I didn't draw my punch card. I'm like, are you kidding me?
So when you actually punch them.
Yeah, I punched him right in the face.
Yeah, that's when you actually do it. It's in the rules.
It is. It should be in the rules because that was just ridiculous. So, but it was fun. They had a great time with that. We also played the next day after we got back from the escape room, we played Quartz. And a lot of people have been griping about Quartz and saying, oh, it's too random, it's too much to take that. But I'll tell you, playing it over several times, I'm starting to realize the nuances of the game that aren't evident the first time you play.
Oh,
it's true. I know, TC, you're skeptical, but it's very
true. I'm not skeptical.
Yeah, right.
I think you're totally right. There's got to be. It's got to be at least 17 levels.
There are 17 levels of play in Quartz, and you only accepted one. So you need to go down deeper. I'm not saying that it's the deepest game in the world, but there are nuances that you learn or you get used to when you play with different groups and also over time. And we just had a good time. When we've known each other for so long, it's like I said when I tweeted it out, I said I'm teaching them how to play Quartz, but I don't have to teach them how to be evil because these types of games, we just love digging at each other and doing, you know, kind of take that move. So it was a lot of fun. So that was my weekend, and I recommend people go and play an escape room because they're a lot of fun. Daryl, what have you been doing?
Future Jessica here again. At this point in the podcast, Daryl speaks for a length of time, and there is a regular and persistent popping that occurs in the audio, and we really apologize for this. Once he stops talking, the guys realize something was wrong and fix the issue, so when the news brief begins, the issue should be fixed. But we apologize for the irritating popping that's about to occur while Daryl is speaking. That's what they get for still not having mentioned why Phil Fangirl is missing.
Yeah. I went to WashingtonCon this past weekend, down in Washington, D.C. You know, WashingtonCon, like Washington.
Oh, I thought it was like a laundry convention.
Yeah.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Did everybody smell nice?
No, some people there do need to go to a WashingtonCon. but, you know, it's the few and far between gamers, but it's just still like, come on, guys. Anyway. So I went to WashingtonCon, it was the second year. It was about, I'd say, a little short of 900 people there total, like between the 2 days. which for a second year convention is fantastic. It's kind of nice because it reminds me a bit of Unpub's earlier days. Like the first year was in a conference hall in a church, and now it was at the Georgetown University Conference Center. So a huge step up in growth for both attendance and venue and all that. So, had an absolute blast. Went with Brad Smoley. So we went to run Unpub there and to play some games and meet some peoples. And that's what we did. So while I was at WashingtonCon, I was able to get in part of my very first game of Scythe.
Just part?
Just didn't play the whole part. Thing.
The time ran out. We had to close the hall, unfortunately. We were told originally that it wasn't going to be a problem where we were, and we could stay there as long as we needed to finish the game up. And then about 45 minutes before the hall closed, they were like, yeah, never mind. You guys got 45 minutes left. And we're just like, oh. Should we keep going? And we just kind of cleaned up at that point. But that's not anything against Scythe. We got about 6 rounds of play in, probably a little bit more than that. I already had 2 stars on the board. I think almost everybody did. We played a 5-player game. And I am quite surprised by it, truth be told. It looks a lot heavier and drier than it's really going to play. It looks like it's going to be a big miniature war game kind of thing. And it doesn't play like that at all. Honestly, I don't know. I think you could probably play the game for the most part without even touching the rule book. I think everything's just kind of, this makes sense. Once you know what the icons are and stuff, it's like, oh, okay, your player board's everything. And I don't know. I just kind of like the elegance of how smooth that was. I need to play through a whole thing to have a complete review, but I will say the one thing I am concerned about, and I'm going to bring up a little bit later, but is that the one thing I'm going to look forward to when I play a full game is I have this fear that the game's just going to end abruptly, kind of like Euphoria. It does use a bit of the Euphoria engine. And that's going to kind of be an anticlimactic ending, and it's going to be a little disappointing if that's the case. But like I said, I liked what I've been playing so far. So that's what I thought about Scythe. I played Scythe, part of it. I sort of played Scythe. obviously, I played a bunch of prototypes. I played Brad Smalley's Valor City Vigilantes, the latest edition of that. That game's coming along really nicely. Josh Temkin's new game, Commissioner, where you're kind of cops and you're detectives and you're using informants to solve crimes in the different levels of the Bronx or in New York. So you're trying to hit all the boroughs and solve certain crimes based on dice rolls and such. It's a little bit like the Isbahan bottom to top leveling die system. So there's that with Commissioner. I played one prototype that really stood out. It's because it's designed by a 14-year-old kid, and he was there, and it was Media Tycoon. And I gotta say, I was really, really impressed. It's his very first game he's ever done. He's been working on it for a little less than a year, and it's a game about, or it's a game with set collections, set allocate, or, resource allocation, resource management, and bidding. Bidding's its main heart. And I don't like bidding games, but I actually really liked it in this. And it was, really cute and really clever, and Media Tycoon makes it sound really heavy, and it wasn't. It was a really quick pick-up-and-go. We played a 2-player game in, 20 minutes. And so it was fantastic, and I absolutely, absolutely, absolutely liked it a lot. It still has flaws. It's a 14-year-old. It's his very first design. But it's got a lot of promise. And I think if a publisher ever saw it and signed it, I think it's got a lot of promise to be like that. Hey, my first bidding game or my first, your resource management kind of game. So it's simple enough to jump right into, but also had a lot of depth to it on the back end. So
cool.
That's by Adam Bressler. I got to mention his name. So good kid.
How old did you say he was?
14.
14? Really? Wow.
14. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. So, really good. And so there was that. Then, I did a booster draft Magic the Gathering.
But it was Conspiracy, though, right?
It was Conspiracy Take the Crown, and I did it with Dave Chalker, Jay Treat, and myself. So, I didn't know Jay Treat was, like, huge into Magic, and it's kind of reminiscent of when I used to be really big into Magic. But I wanted to do it because Conspiracy is made for booster drafting. So if anyone doesn't know, I mean, everyone knows Magic, so I'm not going to tell you what Magic is.
No, what is it, Daryl?
There's these cards in there called Conspiracies, and they affect the current draft, or they affect the game that you're going to play afterward, and they don't count towards deck limit. So, like, there's hidden agendas where you play, they just, before you start the game, you just set them face down next to your deck, and then whenever the thing triggers, you flip it over. And there's things like monsters that are, their power and toughness are equal to the number of cards that you've previously drafted that round, that pack round. So, like, you have to have a piece of paper and a pen. You have to write stuff down constantly. But
sounds horrible.
What? Oh my God. Not know about that part.
Yeah, but it's like, it's cool. Like, you just have, like, I'm writing an 8, and you just tuck it next to everything you draft like that. You have to have face up so everyone knows what it is.
Wait, but you can't write on the card?
Well, you, of course you could write on the card. Of course you could.
But then you wouldn't be able to sell it later to put a down payment on your home.
No, all the conspiracy cards are, like, worth nothing. like, after the
What's
fact.
What's the
They're
point?
Made just for the booster draft. Because it's all the other cards in the set are the high-value cards. So, but anyway, so yeah, that
it's,
was
it's
fun.
It's a weird thing.
And there's, like, a take the crown element now, or capture the flag kind of element. So someone becomes the monarch, and if you're the monarch, you draw an extra card. But as soon as someone deals combat damage to that player, then they become the monarch, so it's constantly passing around. So it's pretty cool. I taught Brad New Bedford. He backed it on Kickstarter, hadn't played it, so sat him down, taught him two-player. He really liked it. We played Cacao. A little self-serving. I took my copy, or my latest prototype of Die Scrapers, and we played that 3 times there. And really, 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 really happy with how that's progressing right now. I'm actually going to be sending a print and play out to Chris this week, which I know he's not going to be able to get to for like 2 months, but still, he's going to have it as a box. Let's see. So there's that. And then Rob Davio was WashingtonCon's special guest. And it's kind of funny because I've been giving Ben some background info, like he'll email me like, hey, how'd you do this for Unpub? And I'm like, oh, this is what we did, and, you know, whatnot. And so he asked about VIPs, and so he just turned around and did our VIP, how we do VIPs with Unpub, and he just contacted Rob and said, hey, do you want to do that again? So Rob came down, which is really cool. So, you know, hung out with Rob quite a bit. He was doing Seafall demos for people, and he and I had a bit to talk about his new, I guess, project he's doing, which is Restoration Games. And it's where they are taking games from the 70s, the 80s, and 90s, and kind of re-releasing them, like, with new art, maybe tweaking.
Okay, so that's who was doing it, because I was going to say that, like, with the Mystery Mansion thing.
Right, right.
Like, I was going to mention that, but then I couldn't remember who was doing it. So, yeah, okay, so that's Rob Davio doing that.
Yes, it's Rob Davio. So the first three
Why does he want to get back into what he got out of?
Like, because this isn't the big box stuff. Like, it's taking old big box stuff and then but bringing them back into like an indie or label. So he's kind of taking them away. So the nice thing is like as he was telling me, it's like the Parker Brothers and the
Milton Bradley's.
Like, they're a little bit easier to get the stuff from, unless it was, like, a designer that was hired by them to develop the game exactly for them. Then it's trickier. But
I guess I'd better jump on Mystery Mansion before they get to it.
Well, so the first three that they're doing is Stop Thief. This game is bonkers. And he had with him there Dragon Master. And unfortunately, we were trying to find time to sit down and play Dragon Master, but with Seafall demos and all that stuff, like he and I never met up to play Dragon Master. He was like, "Oh, do you know any titles off the top of your head?" And I said, "Yes." And he's like, "Well, which one? Give me one." And I said, Omega Virus.
Yeah.
And I was like, you could easily do it with an app now. You don't need the electronic device in the box.
Oh, totally. But, the electronic device is awesome.
No, I know. But I'm just like, this is how you do it and stuff like that. And he was just like, yep. He goes, you know, one of the people that are helping us is the designer of Omega Virus.
Get out of here.
And like Mike, whatever, I forget his last name. And I was like, really? He goes, yeah, the issue with that is he was working for them and developed it directly for them. So probably not going to be able to do that
one.
I'm like,
probably
damn it!
Hasbro owns the rights to all that then.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, it was a bunch hearing some of the background information and all that stuff. And, you know, just generally catching up with Rob and also talking to him about how Seafall has been received lately. And I haven't played it yet. And he wasn't exactly bashing reviewers. He was not bashing reviewers. But it was interesting to see his take on what people were saying and kind of without spoiling anything, because he knew I hadn't played it yet and I'm going to. He was just like, it's just people are so expecting like the Pandemic Legacy or the Risk Legacy type of legacy game where it's like, oh, we didn't win, play it again, play it again, play it again. He goes, Seafall's not supposed to be that. So, like, each game's going to be about 2 hours. So he's like, it's meatier. It's bigger. It's supposed to last, like, maybe one game a week kind of thing. And I'm like, oh, that's kind of cool. So
we shall see.
Well, the one thing he did say is that at the end of Seafall, the game is still totally playable. Which I was like, nice. You don't have to throw everything out. I guess that's what Lee Cock and he wanted to do with Pandemic Legacy. But Z-Man, but it's not Z-Man. It's whoever. They were just like, no. So he was like, all right. And I'm like, well, hey, you know, as a game designer, I loved all the plastic. He's like, yeah, that was like the silver lining for everybody. So, but yeah, so there was that. And so I had a blast at WashingCon, and that was my very long talk, and I apologize for sucking up so much time there.
That's fine. You haven't been here for a while.
Yeah,
we need to hear your voice.
Yeah, it's strange to even hear your voice because it's been so long.
You know what? I think what it's going to be is I talk so much right now because I'm not going to talk at all during the next segment.
You need to talk all the time during the next segment.
I'm just going to hit mute on my mic to ensure I don't even talk.
No, you can chime in on this because this doesn't have anything to do with... Well, we'll get to that. All right. So we have a couple of news briefs that we want to go over. And we don't normally do news briefs, but there's been two really big pieces of things in the news. Before that, I do want to mention the elephant in the room and the fact that Jessica is not with us on the podcast, which we should have noticed. YouTube, I'm sure you've all noticed at this point, but we should have mentioned at the beginning of the podcast. We're up past her bedtime, so we were not able to record on Sunday because Daryl was at WashingCon, and rather than have yet another podcast without Daryl, we decided to wait. So, but by doing that, we lost Jessica. So,
yeah.
Anyway, we missed.
And I also mentioned that as much as we miss Jessica, you will not miss the popping that you've heard prior to this point from my microphone. So we had a technical difficulty and rebooted. I should sound far better to everyone, and I apologize to annoying everyone during my massive monologue.
We just lost maybe 4 of our 6 listeners because of your microphone, Daryl. So.
All right.
But now we're back and better than ever.
We are back and better than ever. And let's talk about news briefs. Okay, so Daryl might be a little tight-lipped during this next section, but I think that he can still comment because this is just about a lawsuit between 3 people. And 2 of them most people are familiar with. One is Zev Schlesinger, who is the former owner or the founder of Z-Man Games. And a great all-around dude. And Dan Yerington, who is the owner and CEO of Myriad Games, Game Salute. He has other subsidiaries like Ship Naked and things like that. Tabletop Tycoon, so on and so forth. Anyway, so Zev and his partner, Paul Girardi,
yep.
They wanted to open a board game store in Long Island, New York. And so this is something that's been going on for quite a while behind the scenes. I'd learned about this a couple of years ago from Stephen Bonacore and Zev. They couldn't talk about a lot of the details, obviously, but anyway.
Let me put this out here. We are not going to Fox News or CNN this. There's no speculation here because the court documents are public and they're actually posted on BGG now.
Right. So anything that I'm mentioning here are going to be directly from the court documents. Yes. We're not going to editorialize this at all. We're just stating exactly what it is so you know what's in the news if some of you have missed it. It's been pretty big. It's been on Twitter, of course. It's posted on BoardGameGeek, so many of you have probably already seen it already. But we felt like since it's been a good hot topic, we should do our due diligence and mention on the podcast. So in 2013, In 2012, they got together and decided that they wanted to work with Dan Yerington, Zev, and Paul to open a store called Zap to Games. And basically, I'm not going to go over the entire case, but the gist of it is that Zev would pony up $100,000 of his own money, and that Dan, using his distribution network through Myriad Games and his infrastructure, would handle the back and forth between like distribution and getting games into the store and so on and so forth. This is something that Dan had done for a few locations with his Myriad Games, and a matter of fact, even with full disclosure, had approached me about doing the same thing in North Carolina, and of course I passed, but... back in the day, it was kind of a viable option. That's before things started going kind of south. But that's neither here nor there. So over the course of the proceedings, it came to light that against the operating agreement between Zev, Paul, and Dan, Dan had gone ahead and tried to set up the lease for the store under the Myriad Games name. And then it didn't work. But so they caught on to that. Then they also, Dan, opened up a bank account for the entire store and took a loan out against the store for $65,000 and was not being forthcoming with neither Zev nor Paul as to what that money was being used for. Zev and Paul both asked for access to the bank account and... wanted access to the QuickBooks so they could see what was going to happen. Also, during the time, some of the distribution models were not being upheld for the game, for the company. So the store was suffering monetarily and, of course, with product. So basically an overall mismanagement, and that's pretty much what this suit is a breach of contract and a mismanagement. They still, I don't think, know the details of everything that the loan was taken out for.
According to the document, it said to repay a line of credit for Pepsi Incorporated.
Oh, because there was something that was paid out to Pepsi that bounced, and I don't know whether it was necessarily for Pepsi in general. Because $65,000 worth of Pepsi products, that's a lot of Pepsi.
So that's what the document is claiming. It's not saying that's flat out what it was. And again, all of this, you know, it's being claimed.
Yeah, it's all from this document that you're seeing is all basically the suit that's being brought by Zev and Paul against Dan. So it's all from their perspective. We don't know Dan's side of the story. We won't know until the court ruling or the court case, or it has gone to court, unless they settle out of court, naturally. But overall, there's a lot of money being, you know, flung around here and a lot of weird kind of, I don't know, I won't say... it's just basically a mismanagement of either there's miscommunication, obviously, between the parties and also mismanagement of the actual money. And Dan seems to have taken over complete operations of the store. He also fired Paul, and Paul had no idea why he was being fired as manager of the store and so on and so forth. So it seems to be a little mudgy. It's a weird situation. So I would recommend you go into Board Game Geek and read the full court documents, which we've done, and kind of see the money's being thrown about. Also, they wanted to, at one point, Zev and Paul wanted to buy out Dan's investment in the company, but because it was so high and because of the loan, they were not able to do so because they didn't have the cash flow to do it. So they're all tied in this together, and eventually the store closed.
And well, it closed without Mike and... Paul, that's the part I don't think we can talk about. Well, according to the court document, it was closed without their awareness or approval.
Okay, so yeah,
according to the document.
According to the court document, there you go.
Yes.
Yes.
They claim they were not aware that the store was closed.
So so basically what they're talking about with fraud, and this is directly from the document, says they claim that Yarrington made these representations intending to defraud Schlesinger and Girardi into entering a three-way partnership whereby he would be able to capitalize on Schlesinger's investment to the benefit of Myriad, profit Myriad by overcharging Zapped Games for the cost of the store's inventory and access monies belonging to Zapped Games and the store. That is directly from the document. And now what that's saying... I mean, it's not. It's actually the document itself is not filled with a bunch of legalese. It's pretty straight on, you know, straight English. But basically, that's saying Dan wanted to form this so that he could rip off the company for his own intentions. And we don't know. Again, this is just simply from the document itself. We're not editorializing at all, but that's what the document is stating.
Yeah.
So it was a breach of contract, breach of trust. There was some weird goings on that was being involved with this particular company, the board game store in question, Zapped Games. And so this is all surrounding, of course, and getting Myriad Games involved in this because it was formed under the allegiance of using Myriad Games distribution and so on and so forth. Now, since this has happened, and in the past, you know, 3 years, I guess, since this has happened, and now we're in 2016, Myriad Games has closed several different locations, not just this store. So... that has to be kind of factored into kind of what might be happening here, whether it's a cash flow problem or just simply an overreaching of not necessarily a franchise, but I guess you can call it a franchise as such. Anyway, we can go ahead, TC.
I think it's just it's one of those things like where we've been, you know, we've talked about this kind of thing for a while now, and a lot of stuff like this just eventually appears, like, later.
Right.
It takes a while for a lot of this stuff to be, like, resolved. So we're seeing the outcomes of some of the things that, like, we were. It's not like we're involved in them, but like from being involved with GameSalute, you get to overhear some of the other things that are going on. That then you can't say anything about, and still can't say anything about. So, at this point, it's like we're still in that same boat. Can't say anything, but kind of, you know, may have been old news to us that this was around.
And I think for a lot of people who are kind of, you know, have a tap into the industry, have known that this was coming. And as a matter of fact, it surprised me that it hasn't come out before now. But you're right.
Yeah, it took a while.
It took a while for them to basically, they had to get all of their, you know, communications together. The law team had to make sure that all their T's were crossed and their I's were dotted. So it's taken that long for this to come to fruition for an actual court case. And this is not, you know, I mean, it's not billions, but there's still a significant amount of money that is being asked for. Part of the court case said that Zev and Paul said they've been damaged as a result of Dan's actions in excess of $75,000. So specifically, Zev lost his entire capital contribution of $100,000, and Paul has been damaged by lost wages. Also, as a result of Dan's unauthorized firing of him, and additionally the loss of his one-third share of profits after Zev and Myriad's total contributions were satisfied, further Dan clandestinely shut down an otherwise valuable and potentially profitable asset in the store without the requisite authority and took possession of any and all inventory within the store that was purchased by Zapped Games for the store. So that's basically the crux of the fraud too, is not only getting back initial investments, but because Dan didn't have the authorization, basically based on their contract of agreement between all three of them to do any of this stuff with the store.
It's just weird. I mean, I just can't imagine, like, especially like, so I like work at a casino. I just can't imagine if I like showed up tomorrow to work at the casino at my scheduled time, and there were no slot machines. There was nothing there. I just walk in, and there's, you're like, wait, what? Oh yeah, it was closed. You're like, wait, what? Like that? I don't know. I mean, it seems like this is very similar to that kind of feeling. Like,
wait, yeah, what? It's like, what? I mean, it's like you open up. Well, I mean, it's with anything. If you open up any kind of store and you have a partnership with somebody, you walk in the next day and all of your stuff's gone. And you're like, what the crap?
Or if you don't have access to the bank accounts anymore.
Yeah, well, not only that, but access to the bank accounts, period. Like, in the document itself, it states that the extent, I think, that Zev and Paul had access to was writing checks and everything. They didn't see any of the ins and outs, what money was being put where. They didn't have access to the QuickBooks. No. So...
Yeah, well, yeah, and it claims that... You know, when he closed the store, he also closed all the bank accounts, transferred the money, took the stock over to the other stores, you know, whatever. So, I mean, it's a bigger deal. And, I mean, if you look at it's like 50-something points of where they're saying.
Yeah, there's a lot of points, yeah.
You know, where they're claiming stuff. And everyone's saying 46 is, like, the biggest one, and that's the one I just mentioned about closing the store and stuff.
Right,
but,
right. Yeah, after several months,
it flat out sucks for everybody involved.
Line 46 says, after several months, Zevinger and Paul learned that Dan had unilaterally closed the store, canceled the lease, taken possession of all inventory therein, and closed all bank accounts related to the store. That's item 46. So, yeah basically, you show up to work one day, and not only is the store closed, everything's gone.
Yeah, it's that's what I'm saying.
It's like when the Colts moved out of Baltimore. They just did it in the cover of night and moved. You know, it's just weird.
Yes. So what a weird story.
There's our editorial there's our editorial comment. What a weird story. We never saw it coming.
Yeah. But again, accused, not at all guilty. Wait for a judge and a jury to say what's going on. So
even in the post here, there's a post from Myriad Games from Dan, and this is his press release. He says, some of you may have seen a press release that mentions a lawsuit filed against Myriad Games and me. We deny the allegations, but we will not try our case by press release, even though this is a press release. But we will present a vigorous defense in the courtroom where the case will be decided on the facts. I have been in the industry for 20 years, since 1996. Myriad Games has been doing business since 1999. Neither I nor Myriad Games have been sued before. We trust that our customers, suppliers, and vendors will rely on their own positive experiences. Thank you kindly, Dan Yerington.
Yeah, so, and this is one thing I want to stress here as well. I mean, it's Dan Yerington / Myriad Games that are... being sued in this, not Game Salute, not Ship Naked.
Right.
So it's a separate thing altogether.
Yeah, and the thing is that's obviously whenever a lawsuit is brought against a party, there's going to be some negative backlash. And even, oh my gosh, the comments pages on Board Game Geek with this post is like 5 pages long. It's just, a lot of people are going to be editorializing it outside of all this because of the simple nature of all this being released. But again, we will stress we're not taking one side or the other, but this is a lawsuit and it'll be tried in a court of law, and eventually it will come out whether there was fraud involved or not.
Yeah.
So there's your story. That's all we have to say about that. Let's move on. There's another
one quick bit
sure,
of news.
Sure, please.
As well.
Fantasy Flight. Fantasy Flight and Games Workshop are parting ways. Boom. Done. No. I'm probably the only one who will have anything to say about this, but I don't like it.
You don't like it?
No.
Why?
Because Fantasy Flight's been doing a great job with the Games Workshop license.
Well, yeah, that's great. But...
But what?
I mean, they
play devil's advocate.
I just think it's only good that Fantasy Flight Games is getting out of this. So, like, I totally understand where you're coming from. Like, they do a great job with the Games Workshop stuff. I don't know why Games Workshop would ever want to part this thing.
I'm wondering, it may not be a Fantasy Flight thing. I mean, I'm wondering if it's part of the Asmodee partnership or something like that, and Games
Workshop's like, we don't want
part of this.
No, I think from what I've seen from both the press release and the news that's come out, the fact that they have been supporting Conquest, and there's tournament kits that were on their way, and so they've been canceled, and that store owners won't be held responsible for this, they'll get their money back, so on and so forth. This was not on Fantasy Flight's part. I think this was Games Workshop.
I would, knowing their history, I would probably agree. And that's why I'm saying I totally agree with you when they did a good job, like, holding up to their end of the bargain with, like, Games Workshop titles. But
yeah.
Workshop is like a sinking ship. In my opinion, they're like a sinking ship. And they keep trying to stop people from being fans of them.
But that's the point, though, is that everything, I mean, this is, people have been saying Games Workshop's been a sinking ship for 15 years, and has it sunk? No. It's like the ever-lowering Titanic, but the problem is that what Games Workshop's doing now, and I think that's why Games Workshop pulled this, is they've realized that since they re-released Space Hulk, and they can, you know, they used to put out tabletop games a lot, and good tabletop games. And I think what they're realizing now is their bread and butter is no longer viable now with all their minis because they're so freaking expensive. Now they're thinking, well, we can at least shore up some of our sinking ship, so to speak. We can put some ballast back in there by publishing.
Didn't they have that story? No, sorry. Didn't they have that story? Like though, like when we read that story like a year ago?
Yeah,
like they're starting to put out board games. Well, where are they?
Well, I mean, other than like, well, they've got the Horus Heresy, the newest Horus Heresy variation, which costs $120, but that's neither here nor there. Which okay. I mean, I totally want it. I just haven't bought it because it's so expensive. But that's my problem, though. Is like, I love the Games Workshop world. I'm a huge. I used to be a 40K player, and I don't have time for that anymore. But I love the universe and the flavor behind it. So, for Fantasy Flight to put out things like Relic and Forbidden Stars and games like that that I think are top-notch and good quality using that license in that universe, it's disappointing to me that now it's going to go back to Games Workshop. They might still be able to work with the creative team that came up with some of these things, probably not Corey, but you know, other people who might have been involved with it, and they can create their own. Games Workshop's not bad at creating games, but they're bad at business models, and I'm afraid that they're going to try to hybridize all these things, and they're going to be $120-$130 for these games that I want to buy, and I can't in good conscience purchase these games at Games Workshop prices. I just can't.
I just have no... Man, they're so outside of my wheelhouse, Games Workshop.
Yeah, I mean...
They're so far gone from me. Like, at least Fantasy Flight, like, overlaps with my interests sometimes.
Right.
Like, Games Workshop.
You'll never look twice. You'll never look twice at a Games Workshop release. I would. That's why I'm saying, like, this is the news article for me, because I'm one of the key demographics for Games Workshop products. But the thing is now is, like, it just frustrates me that they had licensing money from a company that's making money off their products. And again, I don't know the whole story. It could have been Fantasy Flight saying that, you know, we don't want to deal with this anymore. Or it may have been a contract negotiation thing where Games Workshop said, hey, well, we can make our own board games, so maybe you need to pony up more money for our license and things like that if it's going to be renewed. And Fantasy Flight went, whatever, we got Arkham, so go produce your own games. So they have Star Wars and Arkham.
Yeah, I don't see this being a problem for Fantasy Flight
games.
No, just like, oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Because that's why, like you said, I don't think it was Fantasy Flight that was the main arbiter. Although Daryl's right. I mean, maybe it was just it was too big of a license, and they didn't want us to keep spending the money. And Asmodee said no.
It's possible. That's very possible. Where they can spend money on Star Wars, which is going to sell far light years ahead of Games Workshop stuff. So I don't know, but I don't, as a consumer, as a fan of both Fantasy Flight and Games Workshop, I don't like it. And there you go. There's my opinion.
I don't like it.
I don't like it. Get off my lawn. All right. Well, that's enough about fraud and Games Workshop shenanigans. Let's move on to the meat of the podcast. So, according to these notes written by TC that I have in front of me, in 2010, Roger Ebert said video games can never be art in an article entitled Video Games Can Never Be Art. But more specifically, he said no video gamer now living will survive long enough to experience the medium as an art form. In a broader sense, what he most definitely meant was games can never be art. So basically, what we're here to talk about today is how dumb of a statement that is. Because
I think that's very true.
Because he cancels himself out by saying, you know, well, in a broader sense, what he said, meant was, you know, no video gamer now living will survive long enough to experience the medium as an art form. I mean, you could say that about any major artist.
Well, right. And the thing is like, you know, we're going to define some of these topics as we talk through these. And some of these talks or discussions will be very esoteric, but that is the nature of art.
Oh, man, esoteric. I love it.
So now we're getting... Okay, so TC, calm down a little bit. He's getting a little excited about this. This is definitely...
We're dropping pieces here. So excited.
I'm going to take a little swig of water here and get myself lubed up. So... Okay. So anyway, basically, Roger Ebert, may he rest in peace, was totally stupid for saying that, because we're here to prove... one way or the other, but also to play devil's advocate on one side or the other, that games can be art, or can they not be art? What games are art? What games are total crap and should not be considered art whatsoever? But by doing this, we're going to open up the floor now and ask some questions. So the first thing is first, why do you think someone might think that games can never be art? And what's wrong with this medium? Why do you think that people don't believe that games themselves could be art in an art form? So, TC, why don't you start us off?
Okay. I wrote some notes for myself. But, you know, just in general, I think when someone looks at something and says, oh, that can never be art, they usually are coming from an outside perspective and have not experienced the medium. So if someone, say your entire idea of art to you is a panel of like canvas on the wall with a frame around it. If someone said, oh, look at this movie. Well, that's art, right? Like you would go, no, this painting on the wall is art. That movie, that's just a movie. So I think for me, it's just like a complete perspective. If you have like his we'll talk about like high levels of taste and everything that Roger Ebert talks about a little later, but like the idea is that if you have a perspective that you're not familiar with, like I mean it's really easy. What I said was it's really easy to see the progression of like movies, of art, of music, of writing, of video games, and it's kind of hard for someone who isn't in the know to kind of get an idea of like how board games have progressed. Because people just still consider board games or even video games as like children's toys.
Yeah.
And they never explore the genre. So they just assume that there is nothing bringing it to a higher level.
Well, it's like when you ask that question, when you say like, well, I design board games or I publish board games or I play board games. Initially, the first two things people will mention, oh, you mean like Monopoly or Risk?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. They just don't know. Because they're not exposed to that. They're not exposed to the interior. They don't have the perspective of the inside baseball, so to speak, that we are in our hobby and community. And it's like that with all other mediums, like movies. Now, I think you're right about perspective in the fact that a normal moviegoer or viewer is going to be like taking, you know, they're going to go see the average maybe like 5 to 10 movies a year. And they're going to be these big blockbusters or popcorn flicks or whatever. They're not going down to the Chelsea over here on the corner where they basically play every indie movie on demand. They don't realize the ins and outs of what makes a movie and can be an art form. So I think that that's kind of where we're coming from. And I see that's what you're talking about, where perspective. So, I mean, Daryl, do you have something to add to that with what TC said?
He kind of copied what I wrote. I just want to point out I was the first one to put notes in here. So
I had this note in here though.
No, I was the first one. I'm sorry, my chair is very creaky. I need to buy a new one. I'm well aware of this.
Jessica is going to scold you.
I thought it was the pills that you were popping.
No, it's the chair. And you know, hey, more people buy my games than I can buy a new chair. I can afford one.
You should do Patreon for that.
We're going to create a State of Games Patreon to buy Daryl a new chair.
That's right. All right, so I'm just going to read what I have, even though it's going to kind of reiterate what TC said. But mine wasn't perspective, it was logic, and that was knowing the definition between fine art versus applied art. You know, when someone says what is art, they're going to define it with Mozart, Michelangelo, other sculptors, painters, and musicians. And in that case, and in their definition, they're correct, but that's, like I said, fine art. Applied art is where it's more, where movies, modern art, books, you know, and yes, that's where I think board games are within that as well.
So. And I think that's a subset of what you and I do. I mean, and UTC now more so because you've gotten used to the tools and you have a very artistic mindset. Graphic design is an applied art. but it can still be art, because what we do as visual communicators and graphic design means to organize according to a plan. Then that is what we do. We set forth to apply something visually to organize it so that we save processing time to the brain. This is all straight from my lectures in class, but literally this is what I tell. I reiterate the entire semester. That is what we do as graphic designers. We organize things according to a plan. The design means to do so according to a plan, but that's applied art, because you're applying rules and subsets of rules, why we can use icons, why the brain works a certain way and recognizes icons instead of words, and so on and so forth. But they can, the beauty behind art and applied art is organization and, breaking things down, basically organization and alignment and all these different things, and saving processing time. That is a byproduct of beauty. Our brains perceive that as beautiful because we're able to look at a game, process a game, and play that game. So that's art in itself, just by the definition. So
it's not even just that, though. I mean, it's also, it opens itself up for you to be emotionally involved with it. It's not just a flat thing. Like,
right.
You know, like paintings, like, okay, yes, those are flat things, but they stir an emotion within you. Like, that's what makes great art great.
Yes, projecting mood, evoking emotion. These are all things that art does. That's why that I think that by selectively saying, like Roger Ebert said, that video games and games themselves can never be art, well, that's just silly, because games elicit emotions. Now, some could argue that board games only elicit emotion because of the people you're playing with, possibly, but you know, sometimes you can play a solitary game. I can play Arkham Horror by myself and still elicit an emotion from me. And I said on this subject why do I think that some people might not think that games are art? I said it's because art is subjective and games have rules and structure. So there's a defined beginning and end. In the most cases, there's a clear winner and there's no room for interpretation. In fact, if your game is open to interpretation, people bitch about it. They just do.
which is true.
It is very true. So if your rules are not clear and you have to house rule something or bring it up to a vote or something like that, people get cranky about it because they're like, well, this is supposed to be very defined, and maybe that's a byproduct of our lives too, of seeing beauty through organization. We want to play something that's very clearly defined. We want to have the experience of that and not have to think, you know, basically make up portions of the universe and things for ourselves. But I think it's because games themselves are subjective. You get what you want out of them. You can see them in front of you, and part of the applied art of that becomes beauty, which is subjective art.
Well, okay, so they're subjective, right? But
yeah.
So you guys, and we'll do two sides of the coin. So you guys are both trained graphic designers, and
you're one of us talking, anyway.
So you have the applied idea of art. Now, when you do graphic design, I think most graphic design, you might agree, hopefully, that most graphic design is meant to not stand out, but to recede. It's just be part of the whole.
It should be effortlessly. It should be effortless to, absorb. Is basically you as a good graphic designer, like we also use art, and obviously to just artists in general, like we have to have art in our board games to be graphic design, but our graphic design is supposed to get out of the way and let everything else speak for itself. Like whatever you're playing the game, just get out of the way. You want to make sure that the processing time and everything that you see there is limited, so that you don't even notice the graphic design. Great graphic design and elegant graphic design are those that do recede, that make it very easy for people to absorb what you're trying to show them, the message you're trying to convey, and they don't make too much of themselves.
So if it's all about, you know, receding, well, I mean, in some cases it's about showing off, but like in most cases it's about receding, right? Where can you pick out things from like graphic design and in games that are actually fine art? Because those parts that you're talking about are definitely an art that is more of like a craft to me. Like,
it is a craft.
It's
yes.
about it's about reinforcing logic, like Daryl was saying, right? But are there parts of graphic design that become art, that go out of that and go outside of that? And are there parts of games that are legitimately fine art?
Well, here, this, well, man, you just opened up a can of worms.
Of course, that's the whole
thing. So here's
point.
The thing, like, to me, the entire, the box and everything within it is the art piece for a board game. I don't think you can take bits away and say, no, that's the art. This is the art. Because at that point, it's only looking at a piece of the entire subject. It's like, you know, just cutting off, you know, a small square of a Starry Night and saying, that's the art in the entire piece. That's the art, not the rest of it. And I disagree with that. It's the entire thing as a whole encompassed together. And honestly, I think board games even open up to the players are becoming part of the art piece. And I think if you're saying, no, there's a board game and therefore this part has to be the art, well, then that's bringing in a whole issue that I have with as a graphic designer where, and I know there's designers out there that are like, well, you know, I'm shunning your input on how I'm laying this out because I'm following the golden ratio or I'm doing the rule of the triangles. And it's just like, no, it's a game. Like, it should still be functional. Like, don't do every single piece like it's going to frame in the frickin' Louvre because it's not going to, ever. The whole piece has to work together and still make sense for the player. That's how it's going to be perceived on if the entire thing is a good game, let alone a good piece of art, is if people like it and still continue to use it. If it's just, like, gotten and thrown on a shelf of shame somewhere, that's bad art. Like, it's just a bad game design top to bottom. And, you know, sad to say, graphic design and art can kill a good board game design. So, I think it's got to be the whole thing. You can't take just the game board out and say, this is that. Like, case in point, Road to Canterbury. Road to Canterbury actually uses pieces of real art from way back when. I don't even know the dates. But they, I mean, it's public domain art that they used to illustrate everything. And it's on the boards, it's on the cards, and you can't look at the board and just go, oh, that's the art piece, because look, it's using real art. Well, yes, but so is everything else in the game. It's the whole game together. You're only looking at a piece of the puzzle.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
and
go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. I was just going to say, I think what you're saying is correct. Is that, like, you know, you have to look at the whole aspect of the game, but it's kind of hard to, I mean, it's kind of hard almost if something like you're going to look at the game as a full whole and what it's presented to, like, whoever's playing it, and right. Even those choices that don't use the specific art, or if someone makes a completely abstract game, it may be fine as long as it supports the presentation, the overall, like, I want people to feel this way. If that follows what the game's trying to be, then I think it can move on to fine art. I think that, like, it's not just applied. It can be poetic.
Right.
I think poetic is a good, it's a good metaphor for this, because poems themselves can be open to interpretation. It's an art form, but there are certain rules. I mean, like we're talking about this with applied art, there are certain rules that you use to define what is good as far as, like, making something playable. If it's elegant, those of you out there taking drinks, drink, because I've said elegant again. I'll bring up Isbahan a little bit too, by the way, so don't think you're getting away without a mention of Isbahan. But it's just, art in itself has to be something that you engage with, and a poem is the same way. It has structure. I mean, poems can be broken down. They have iambic pentameter and all the different forms, and you can try different ways to make poetry work, and there's free form. There's, you know, we can have a def jam session here if we want to, but
yeah,
board game, yeah, exactly. But board games are the same way. As I said, there's and graphic design is the same way, in that we have certain rules, but by adhering to those rules, we are creating something that is far greater than the parts. It's the whole. We have to see the whole picture of what we are looking at and not break it down into its individual parts, because the individual parts should be indiscernible. It should become one cohesive thing that we are engaged with and engrossed by. Wow. Okay. So
it's okay to have a favorite thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, a favorite part.
And we may be breaking them down later, but, like, still.
Right, right, yeah. Right. Okay, so let's Daryl, you brought up Road to Canterbury.
Yeah.
And so we were talking about some examples, in our opinion, of games that are specifically art. They don't necessarily have to be good games, but they're definitely art. There are certain games out there that I do think that fall into the categories of certain art things. TC, like what example from you would you think a game that is specifically art?
Well, I wrote down some things that I thought, one, like, because originally I think I wrote like that, what is art, and then what game do you think is good but is art, and then what game do you think is bad but could be considered art, right? Like, I thought that would be kind of interesting because, I mean, even though we talk about the whole. So I wrote down a few, but like one of them that I wrote down, which may be different for everybody, but I wrote down Freedom, which was the historical game about the moving slaves from the South up to the North with the,
Underground Railroad.
Underground Railroad. Yeah. There you go. Underground Railroad game. And the reason why I said this moves itself from a specific like expression of just gameplay versus mechanics and how those things do is that it adds several things. It is a game where the people that you are helping are abstracted to cubes, which whatever, they're just tan natural cubes that you are moving upwards on these what could be considered tracks on a map of the United States. And technically, none of that has to be there, right? Like, no, you don't have to have a map of the United States. There does not need to be the applied theme of this. It could just be simply mechanics trying to move these things over. But it's the, for me, a lot of what art that board games do, or just games in general, they do two things. Like, they sacrifice gameplay a little bit for a specific agenda, and they also have mechanics that support the feeling they want you to have. And usually this, like, I think games do a really good job of representing what people actually do in life, and that how they represent real things can actually be elevated to art, I think, because you see that. And in this game, in Freedom, you are moving these cubes up there. And the problem is, at points in the game, you have to make tough decisions. And these tough decisions are elevated simply because the movement of those cubes represents actual people. And some of them will be removed from the board, and you can't save them all. And I think that, to me, just like kind of pulls you in a way that other games do not try to do. It's very dark, and it does something, right? And again, I think the person that's making this game is using that sort of mechanic to try to get you to actually feel not just like you are immersed in the subject, but to feel bad for having to make that decision in the first place. And because that is actually a detriment to playing the game, I think it sacrifices a little bit of like the gameplay. You're not going to enjoy doing that if you know what that represents. But it's important that you experience that for the designer of the game so that you can feel like what it must have been like at the time to deal with that, especially from like a historical perspective looking back, right? So yeah, I think as a part of the whole, like that presentation and the theme that you apply to that game really, really heightens it from just like, I don't know, just a cube moving strategic puzzle, solo puzzle, to like an actual like artsy game. That was a long explanation, but
well, no, it makes sense because
it's a lot of points that I was talking about.
Well, it brings up also sort of, and this will tie a little bit into my answer for this as well, but it's because other than the one that I'll mention a little bit later, there's also Swingin' Jive Cat Voodoo Lounge. And that game in itself is a little, it's an art piece. It really is. Both the art and Sergey Marcet, who is fantastic as far as an artist and graphic designer, did the art for that game, and just the theme behind the game itself kind of comes, I'd call it kind of an artistic in-joke as far as like the style of the game it is, but also the storyline behind it and the culture that surrounds that game. The people who are in the imaginary world of Swingin' Jive Cat Voodoo Lounge would be like, Yeah, Daddy-O be saying, yeah, man, I'm digging this. I'm digging this conversation. Like, that whole thing becomes part of what we're talking about. But Seth Roback, who's the designer of Swingin' Jive Got Voodoo Lounge, pitched a game to us years ago, back when Swingin' Jive
Got. This game, yeah.
This game. Okay, so this is an art form. This is what we talk about games as art. He wanted to do a game about hobos during the Great Depression. And the game itself was basically you have to go out on the road and ride the rails trying to find work so you could send money back to your family. And you would encounter all kinds of things like the death of fellow hobos and trying to find the right one and avoid the cops and how much time you might spend in jail. And if you don't send enough money back to your wife, she will start to find another man so that she can be, taken care of from another man. And so she might cheat on you or even divorce you or leave you for another man and your kids might starve. I mean, we're talking about some dark, dark stuff.
Was this a LARP?
No. This is a board game.
Board game.
And I'm like listening to this from Seth, and I'm like, that is a fantastic and intriguing idea. I wish that it was commercially viable, but it's just, I mean, you can't sell a game like that. It's like, ride the rails. Do you survive? Do you eat your fellow hobos? Does your wife leave you for somebody else? I mean, these are all things that were true and could happen. But totally super, super dark, and becomes at that point, if that game is actually produced and done, that is an art piece. There's no denying that's an art piece.
I think it's hard because, like, you look at stuff like that. I mean, even like same type of example, like when you reflect society in a certain way, it's perceived as art just in general. But like when you reflect it in a way that makes you feel something that may, again, may be detrimental to the actual playing of the game, you know that the person has an agenda and that person is expressing themselves. And I feel like Seth, in that case, is definitely, like, is going further than what people might expect. And I think that crossing that line helps bring that idea. I think that idea sounds, like, awesome. I don't know how many people would actually play it, but like it sounds like an awesome idea as an art project for a game.
It's a fantastic idea. But yeah, you would have to do it as an art project. You would basically make the game yourself as an art project, do it through GameCrafter or something, so you'd actually have a game you could play. But there's no way in the world that any publisher would ever publish that game. But that doesn't mean it's not. I mean, that again, published games can be art. This one, just the example of it in total, you know, disclosure, is a piece of art. Like, it has to exist only as a piece of art, and I don't think it could exist as a marketable idea outside of that.
Yeah.
And that brings me up to another game, and I don't mean to toot our horns, but I feel like Viva Java exists as a piece of art. Like, it's different than almost any other game out there. It is a game that I think that could exist outside of Dice Hate Me Games, but it came along at a time and we kind of just gelled as to the overarching feel of what Viva Java should be. It is kind of an art piece because not only just the gameplay itself and what's put into it, but also the little bits and pieces that make up the entire game. It's every single piece is designed with an aesthetic in mind, an artistic sentiment, to elicit a response and a feeling for a certain genre or age. Age meaning like generation. And it's kind of an homage to games as art. Like, we both, you know, you and I both wanted to put everything into Viva Java to make it as beautiful as possibly could be. And I think we succeeded. And it exists in my mind as a piece of art. So
I'm trying to think of how that makes me feel. where are my feelings on that, right? So cuz we're talking about feelings tonight. It's great. I agree though, like I always try to think of games as art because then I can think of like some of these things, but I think I have to apply a little too much to Viva Java for art. Now, it represents a lot for me personally and is definitely an expression of myself and the gameplay type that I enjoy. And it is definitely a game that to me is iconic in the sense that, like, I cannot find a similar experience out there. And so that experience that I wanted to create is, like, positive with a competitive edge. And I think for that game, like, I achieved that, but I wanted to, like, but there's so much of a veneer of that coffee, like, world that I just, you know, it's like, it's two things that are, like, trying to, that are existing together, and I think they work really nicely together. But man, do I think it's elevated because of that? I don't know. I think a lot of it's applied art, though. But it definitely is an expression of my own gaming taste, for sure.
It is a lot of applied art, and the fact that myself and Daryl created the art in this, and neither of us are artists, we're graphic designers. It becomes a different form. It becomes an art piece of applied art, because not only is the art that within, like the roasters, the blends, the blend slates, the art that's on the blend slates becomes an effort in creating art, but art through applied graphic design that becomes, like, you know, packaging art. And that's a whole
subset.
Well,
it's just weird, too, because you guys, I mean, this was the first time I was introduced to the idea of, like, Pantone, like, what are they, swatches? Yeah, Pantone swatches. I had no clue what that was. I had designed this game based off of that, and whenever I signed it with you, I designed it because of the Carnival work, and I knew that because of Carnival, like, you guys, like, you specifically knew graphic design. Because I could tell from that you were putting together elements and, like, expanding them in a way that I could not do, and that I only needed that. I didn't want... It's like, so I guess that's part of the art thing. It's like, I didn't want somebody to come in and go, oh, you know what? This needs, like, the Puerto Rico veneer. It needs, like, somebody to draw an island, and then someone to, like, put these little pieces on there and then have this. No, I just wanted someone to go in and go, I want this style. I want this to be applied to everything. All the pieces have that same style, and it's just a graphical style. It's not, like, art. So, like, none of the game is hand-drawn. And I think that definitely gives you an impression of what... Well, okay, maybe the map a little bit. But, like,
yeah, maybe a little bit. Yeah.
But only outline. I mean, it's not, like... It's hand-drawn, but not, like...
It's all a graphical style.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's like, I knew going into that, I was, man, I really would like to do it that way. And it was just super awesome to have you and then also Daryl coming in later just to know that type of style and to be really, like, proficient at it. So I think, like, again, but this is one thing that they talked about, like, that Roger Ebert talks about, like, can a group make art?
Oh, right? Does it have to be individuals? Yeah.
Yeah, it has to be an individual. So is my vision as an artist for Viva Java really, like, there? Or was it just diluted by you and Daryl coming in and going, well, I have my own vision, and therefore our whole game is no longer art. It's just, you know, it's a game.
Yeah, that's go ahead.
I have issues, and I mean, this is also brought up because of, you know, my art teacher in college and such, and his favorite thing is art by committee is not art at all. And to a point, I fully understand and agree with that, because, you know, if, like, TC, I mean, the Viva Java is your art piece. We got our voice in it, but ultimately, at the end, I mean, you know, still yours. But it's, thankfully, at that point, I think, how can I word this? Our by committee is pretty much like, hey, I'm doing this, and I just have a bunch of people that have no idea what the hell they're talking about giving feedback and telling me what to do. I think a lot of games fall victim to that issue. People that think they know better and believe they know better, like the whole, you know, well, I own Photoshop, therefore I am an artist, so I'm telling you that an outer glow and a drop shadow is exactly what that icon needs.
To be honest, for everybody listening, it never needs that.
No, never. Yeah, never.
It never needs that.
With a gradient texture, just leave it alone.
No, that's great. little gunmetal on the outside.
Right. So, I mean, metal. TC, like, yeah, it's, you know, it's, it, Viva Java did get art through committee, but it was still, in the end, yours. I mean, it wasn't people dictating, do this, do that, change this, do that. So, I don't know.
And that's where I still think art by committee is art. I mean, I know that they have trouble with that with filming too, but like they'll give a director and a film an award, but they won't allow for two directors to claim an award together.
Well, think about it. Every single time that there's like a bad movie out, the excuse ends up being, well, the studio was involved. The studio was like, no, we can't do this.
Right, too many cuts. Oh, exactly. Yeah.
So case in point, someone being killed in Serenity.
Case in point, Viva Java.
We don't mention Serenity on this podcast, Daryl.
I was gonna mention a game instead, but I was like, you know what? No, because it's gonna sting.
Don't get me started. It's late, and I will not hesitate to rant. But anyway, so that might be an example of where an art piece might have been better by judged by committee, and therefore Josh Whedon wouldn't be able to do his Hackmaster routine. Anyway, so that's all I have to say about that.
Yep, that's done. That's done. Right. So, hey, I also thought, and this is for a different reason, I also thought Love Letter was art.
That's interesting. And
like I think
Love Letter design, like just as a pure design.
Yeah, because when I first experienced Love Letter, I think it was one of the first that I'd ever played that was like that, like the 16 card, someone going for a minimalist game, but like specifically doing it and doing it in a way that other people had not done it before. And Love Letter kind of, as much as people want to say, well, there's other games that are better than Love Letter, like it kind of inspired a whole line of designers for the next few years. And it definitely inspired me for sure. And I played it and was just like, how is this a game? How is this possible that this works for one, and that it's super fun, and that I can teach it to anyone in like 2 minutes? It like Love Letter blew my mind because it was just a simple expression of a goal. Like the designer had a specific goal in mind. They executed that goal as perfectly as possible. So like high levels of craft. And created this game that, I mean, it can be applied with any theme. It's kind of abstract in the sense that, you know, it's like it's just numbers and cards and abilities, right? But created this system of abilities that interacted in such a way that it was replayable almost infinitely with only like 16 cards. And for me, that type of knowing the designers, like you look at like how art like on a wall is, if you understand like Seiji Kanai and where he's come from and how he would get to the point where he would create Love Letter, it's like this, you can look back at the artist's like motivations and what they wanted people to do and how they wanted people to interact in this game, and you can see like a progression, and that's everything that art critics love. They go, oh, this person, well, he painted this while he was in Malta on vacation, and he had been, you know, expressing himself through colors and synesthesia, right? And this is his expression of like a sunset on the Riviera, right? And like, you're like, oh, that makes me feel like that art has more substance. And so for me, like Love Letter is a really good craft, but is elevated to art because it is an expression of what that person's purpose was. And they do it really well. I don't know. It's a minimalist aesthetic taken to an extreme and done extremely well. So, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would agree with that, that art possibly exists in more than just a visual form. I mean, we talk about books as art, too. I mean, that's written form. That's a particular person taking a storyline and crafting it in such a way that it becomes art. I mean, people would probably lump like Catcher in the Rye in there, you know. J.D. Salinger wrote Catcher in the Rye and then became a hermit for the rest of his life, but that one particular book became so synonymous with an actual art form. The same thing can be said about the structure of design and design itself outside the visual substance. So Again, these are all esoteric concepts, and as you're listening right now, we invite all of you to chime in and tell us your esoteric thoughts as well. Make sure you can go to the guild, you can go to diceapeme.com, you can contact us on Twitter. But let's move on now to the next question, which is, what is an example of a game that is not art? So, TC, what do you think?
Okay, so I'll go first. Game that is not art. So I said Dungeons and Dragons.
Oh! Blasphemy!
No, I know it's blasphemy. But I was like saying to myself, you know, it's like, I guess if you consider it performance art, like, I would say, like, we didn't get to it, but you were talking about, like, parlor games.
Right, interpretive dance and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, Spyfall. Like, you could potentially consider those art because they are, like, a framework that gives you a form of, like, expression. But to me, like, Dungeons and Dragons and maybe not all role-playing games. I'm not going to put all role-playing games in the same category because it's like, I have not played enough to really get an idea. But, like, Dungeons and Dragons itself is a, like, a box, is like a box or book that just, it provides an experience and it allows you to create whatever art you want to do.
Yeah, you, so fill, it, like you fill in the gaps. You fill in the gaps.
Yeah, I think it's like, it enables you, it's a really good, like, I like 5th edition a lot, but, like, it enables you to tell stories and to have fun with each other and to play a game. But that game is free form, and it could be experienced in all kinds of different ways.
Right.
And so I think it's kind of scattershot. It's not an expression of, like, the designer's intention of doing this one thing. And it's also falls victim to what I was talking about with Daryl, with, like, the whole by committee. Like, it is definitely designed by committee. So, like, yes, and like I said, some role-playing games may be, but I think most role-playing games are not going to get to that performance art level. There are definitely exceptions, but, you know, Dungeons and Dragons.
But I guess that belabors the point of, is something that intrinsically enables creativity itself not art? So if it's just something, does it just become a tool in that sense?
And I think that's what I was trying to say. Yeah. Like, I, as much as I think D&D is a thing, I think it also is just a very functional tool, like a pencil.
I think I probably would agree with you on that. I mean, I hate to bring D&D into this, but, I mean, even RPGs themselves, a lot of the art of some RPGs is crafting the world, and some RPGs are much more detailed than others and as far as, like, what those worlds are. But, like, D&D would be one of those GURPS. The whole GURPS system from Steve Jackson is just simply an open-ended tool for you to create your own world. It's a tool for you to be creative and to create your own art. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's not, in some semblance, some sort of piece of art, but at its base level, it's a tool.
It's tough. You were going to mention parlor games in the art section, and I just, like, I don't know if I agree. I just don't know if I agree. It's an enabling device. Even at, like, I think Spyfall is very thematic and brings out, like, these feelings of actually being a spy in a weird spot. Like, I love that, and I almost think that's art. But it's,
well, I'm glad you brought that back up, because I didn't mention the parlor game, because now that you're talking about it, you're right. A parlor game in itself is a structure to create an art piece of your own. And I think you're right about that. I think it becomes
so
more
close.
A tool.
It's close.
It's a tough dividing line.
I will not punch anybody if they disagree.
Well, I mentioned that an example of any game that is not art is anything but Martin Wallace. it's simply because...
What about Doctor Who the card game?
Oh, Jesus.
Oh, definitely that one is not art. That's not even Doctor Who. it's Doctor Who the hell thought this was a good idea.
And here's the thing. I don't mean to belittle any games by Martin Wallace. I don't enjoy them. I just, as a general principle, most Martin Wallace games I'm not going to enjoy. But the reason why I bring it up is because they're very, very tightly structured. They're what I call spreadsheet games. Not all of them, but most of them. Those types of games, yeah, I guess you could interpret them as art, but they're more like scientific routines. They're mathematical formulas. They're trying to not necessarily even solve a puzzle, but they're just going through a motion to achieve a certain goal. There's no open-endedness to most of them at all. And I'm not saying a lot of Martin Wallace, but there are plenty of other games and Euro games that do this. That doesn't necessarily mean that you might not consider them art, but I don't. I consider them...
They're historical reflections, so there is something there, I think, but not necessarily what you're looking for, what we're trying to define, I think.
Right, exactly.
Like, but I will say, you know, stuff like when London, for example, has, like, the pestilence and, like, the rats and everything, it's trying to represent how life might have been and how you might manage that, right? And it feels bad, and he wanted you to feel like this is bad.
Well, you
and
definitely feel something bad about it. You definitely feel bad.
Yeah, yeah. Some people rage quit.
But it does. You're right. It does evoke an emotional response when you have that type of thing in a game with a negative. And of course, obviously, you are a big proponent of positive player interaction. When you have a negative feedback loop, Dan Patrice of the Greek Geek All Stars, he is just known for that. He hates feeding mechanics. He hates negative feedback. I mean, in the Year of the Dragon, I thought he was going to like flip the table when we played that game, and. Just
what do you have to like feed the dragon? Is that
in the Year of the Dragon is basically it's a war of attrition. Games like in the Year of the Dragon, a lot of Martin Wallace titles, they're wars of attrition. You're trying to lessen the amount of damage done to you so that you can eke out a couple of points. And there's games out there that you even win if you have the fewest negative points, which is insane. But it's like, but those elicit an emotional response, and is that part of art? Yes, it is. And that's the weird part that we're trying to define right now. I just feel like you're right. Okay, like in London, it does elicit an emotional response when you're trying to battle versus the plague cubes. And so does that push it closer to art? Possibly. But again, most of the time when you encounter that type of game, you go into it and it's mostly just a cold, sterile environment that you just do stuff.
That is probably... That may be true. Some people out there are going to disagree, but I think
that
may be true in some cases. So, Daryl, what were you going to say? What were you going to, Daryl, answer us with?
I was going to, Daryl, answer you with tic-tac-toe. And if that wasn't satisfactory enough for you snobbish board game standards, then toss across.
But
I don't know. I think toss across elevates tic-tac-toe.
Oh, God, maybe
art. Is it a reflection on society?
Well, let me ask you this then, Daryl. What do you think about like a game like chess or Go?
Well, they're totally art pieces.
Really?
Oh, God, yeah.
Why?
Well, a lot of that is, you could argue that chess actually delves into a little bit of fine art, being that they're... sculptures. There's actually sets of both of those in museums as art.
It's true, but those are the pieces, the components of that piece of art.
No, I'm talking about the whole setup. Boom. Okay.
So I think it does relate back to what TC was stating about something like Love Letter. It becomes a time-tested and elegant design that becomes elevated to a fine art piece because it is something that has existed because of its simplistic nature, but also its... You know, it's grandiose nature that can be transcended across multiple generations.
Yeah, I guess, but one of my things on my list of not art was chess.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I guess the reason why was it is an abstract game, and it does, like, it is cool that it has stood the test of time, but it is never more than just a game.
Yeah.
It's not a reflect. It's a reflection of maybe like how like it's a really really abstract reflection of how like kingdoms work. But,
yeah, I think I think that honestly, in my opinion, now I understand why Daryl might answer the way he did. But I think
and that's an awesome point. Like the presentation of something does that elevate it to art, right? Is an amazing gold set of chess pieces. I mean, there's this guy that makes like. His own games, and he makes like talking like the Seth thing, like he makes two copies of his game and sells them for like 5,000 each as like fine art
pieces, right?
And they are legitimate games that he's designed that are intricate, but he makes them with like gold and with like all these pieces, right? And they are art pieces. But that game might not actually be good. It's a spectacle now, though.
It just it's an art piece in itself, whether it's good or not, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so that goes into a whole nother discussion that I have that I thought about the other day.
Well, and it also goes into a discussion of some Kickstarter projects that we probably shouldn't mention. So,
all of them.
Yeah, all of them. Yeah.
No, my big thing was like, you know, sort of what you were saying, TC, about, you know, certain pieces of art. And it's like you can overproduce a game to kind of cover up the game's flaws because people are like, ooh, look, it's a really pretty game. And then they get it and they're like, look how pretty this game is. But it plays like crap. And that gets into the whole thing. But that's where I was saying, like, the players actually become part of the art piece. So, you know, if it's not enjoyed, if it's sitting in a box on the shelf, it's not really art at that point. It's when it's out and being enjoyed and there's the interaction and the emotional tie to it. That's when it's art.
Well, and also art can elevate a game more than what it is. And we've had this discussion many times on the Geek All-Stars, but we've talked about it here as well of how components and componentry can elevate a game's enjoyment, whether if you're playing like a prototype that just has, you know, bare bones type of graphic design art versus the actual finished product. Art in itself can aid in the enjoyment of board games. And of course you can do the same thing for movies and things like that. I mean, you how many times have you gone to a movie and said like, wow, that had great effects and cinematography, but the storyline sucked,
you know? Armageddon.
Hey, now Armageddon's a masterpiece.
Masterpiece.
Twister.
Hey, that did not
have good cinematography.
No.
You're right. It was filmed during a tornado.
You don't talk about Twister.
So many greats.
Because Twister is one of my favorite movies of all time.
Twister is a modern classic.
It is a modern classic. I've watched that movie almost as much as Ghostbusters. So anyway.
All right, get into this next part.
I'm contractually obligated to read this next paragraph that TC wrote. So, muggles and norms in the real world view board games as a simple alternative to video games, something to do when the power is out. Or they are viewed as parlor and party games, something to do when you have too many people and or are inebriated and want to get everyone involved. Or in rare cases, as the intellectual alternative to video gaming, something that is worthless if its educational or social value is not repetitively championed.
Yeah, that was a good point, TC.
That was a great...
Or Chris, I mean.
Thank you. I'm glad that I mentioned that. So going into that very thoughtful reflection that I just had, what do you think is the Space Invaders or Pac-Man of board gaming today?
Right. So I put, and I think we can agree, but to show progression of art, right, you have to have a progression. So there's got to be something that starts it.
Has to be a baseline,
and
right, yeah.
Moves. Yeah. So I said, Space Invaders, Pac-Man, Monopoly.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I think that the first thing that comes out of people's mouths whenever you mention board game is usually, oh, Monopoly. Because everybody in the world has played Monopoly at one time in their life.
It's a little regrettable, but, like, you know, it's there.
It is what it is. It's the baseline. But I'll be honest with you. If you break it down from an art standpoint and games as art, Monopoly's up there. I mean, because think about it. How ingrained in our culture is Monopoly? I mean...
It is, but I think the original intention was more art.
The original intention of Monopoly itself was an art piece. It was meant to be passed around from person to person to reflect on the actual societal norms of the time and
the effects of capitalism on you, right?
Like, exactly. It was a political statement.
Only one person gets it.
It was a political statement, and that's the whole reason that the game even existed, was to be as a political statement to stand against the Ayn Randness of the time.
And everyone was like, what's that all about? This game's fun. I want to be the one that does this.
Right, I want to be the one that has all the money now. You know, so, it became a bastardization of itself, but at the time, it was completely an art piece, and I think that's fascinating about the history of Monopoly. Yeah. So, Daryl, you had a different answer.
I did have a different answer, and that was, I took the definition from the question in a different way, too. Mm-hmm. As opposed to being like a timeless title, I took it as define the genre and had many copycats, or, you know, a lot of following board games took bits and pieces from it to, you know, make their game as popular. And so with that, I went with Yahtzee. Yahtzee's also dropped all the time with, you know, oh, you make board games like Monopoly or Yahtzee or Scrabble, pretty much any of those three. But Yahtzee's, especially with the dice versions of games, they're Yahtzee variants. Period.
It's true. I mean, Yahtzee has whereas Monopoly kind of spawned a whole bunch of roll and move stuff, which was regrettable. Mm-hmm. Yahtzee actually spawned a lot of good game mechanics whenever we talk about it, you know, oh, it's the Yahtzee mechanic. You can re-roll three times, and people just automatically get it. They know because it's a good mechanic. Yahtzee's still an enjoyable game. I mean, it's not the deepest game, but it's still fun, and you're just trying to score, and it's largely luck-based, but people enjoy that because it evens the playing field, except for those of us who have bad dice luck, but that's beside the point. Yeah, I agree. I think Yahtzee, Monopoly, I think that we could also probably fit in Risk in that. Some of the ones, especially in our generation, I don't think that we can count like checkers and chess and Go and things like that, because those are...
They're like Pong.
They're Pong, exactly. They're Pong, and the Space Invaders and Pac-Man are Monopoly, Risk, and Yahtzee, and probably Clue. I think I'd even throw Clue in there. But all right, so on the flip side of that, what game do you think is the Super Mario Brothers or Zelda of board gaming? So in other words, what games showed you there could be so much more to gaming, at least in your, we can't really separate this without our own personal reflections on our history of board gaming. So TC, what do you think is the Super Mario Brothers or Zelda?
Daryl, what do you think?
I'm actually changing mine.
Oh, really?
Oh, darn it. Okay, well then never mind. I said Settlers of Catan.
And I initially agreed with him, but then I thought of one that was,
okay, well, I just, you know, I think it stands for itself. Settlers of Catan got a lot of people into gaming. It started the whole, like, Euro craze. And I think it told people that there could be more to games than just seeing what you got.
Yeah.
I think for a lot of people out there listening, probably Settlers was one of those. I mean, and we call them the gateway, the ones that open the door to a greater understanding of board gaming in general. Settlers is one of those, Ticket to Rides, etc. But Daryl, what did you change yours to?
I changed mine to Pandemic.
Pandemic. Oh.
Pandemic. I mean, initially it was going to be Lord of the Rings, and I was like, well, then Arkham. No, let's do Pandemic because it introduces people to co-op. It's a quick... the rules are not that complicated for the game. And it just shows you that there's a whole other side of we're not playing against each other, we're playing with each other against this inanimate object that is the game and trying to beat that. And it just brings a whole other mindset to board gaming altogether.
Okay. Hey, I'm not going to say that because, like, in 10 years from now, I think you'll be completely right. I think there's going to be a huge wave of people that get into it because of Pandemic. So I'm looking at it from... So I would almost give it the, you know, Super Mario Brothers 3.
Which is the best one.
It is so the best one. Which is really good. So
other than Super Mario World, Super Mario World's pretty darn good. But, yeah.
Yeah, I agree. That's the Super Nintendo one, right?
Yeah.
And I have the real answer, like, for Chris's. I know exactly what that one is.
Okay, so I put Fortress America, but I'm really including all the Game Master series.
Oh, okay.
Because back in the day, and that's why I mentioned this, back in the day, we had Payday and Monopoly and Scrabble and Risk and all these, and they were all fine, and Clue. I love Clue. I collect every version of Clue that's ever existed. That's what I do. But when you talk about games that could show you that there's more, me growing up, it was when Milton Bradley finally said and threw down the gauntlet and said, like, people can handle more. They put out the Game Master series. And the first one that I was exposed to was Fortress America. And we used to play that all the time, and it was awesome. And then, of course, Axis and Allies was part of that series. Shogun was part of that series, otherwise known as Samurai Swords. So all these games had advanced rule sets to them. They were far deeper. than anything else you would see. And that's without getting into, I guess, at the time, some Avalon Hill releases and some war games. But Fortress America and the Game Master series, to me, are the Super Mario Brothers or Zelda of my time, because it allowed me to see that, holy cow, there's more out there. There's more cool things happening. And then, of course, we had things that come out like, you know, the Omega Virus and HeroQuest and even Fireball Island. I mean, it's not deep, but at least it showed you that board games could be more than just moving a pawn around a board. These all were kind of the renaissance of board gaming in my mind during the 80s, and that was super cool. So I feel like... Go ahead.
I think that is the Sonic the Hedgehog of board gaming.
I think you would be wrong, sir. I think that yours...
That's a Sega Genesis game type.
That is not... That is
Fortress America sounds like it just came out of Sega.
Sega! Well, you know what?
Vector Man and Fortress America.
Without Sega... We wouldn't have modern video games as we know it right now, because if they had challenged Nintendo, we would not see the excellence that we have in video games now.
I'm not saying it was bad. I liked some Genesis games.
Hey, good. Sonic's. I like Sonic. Sonic's cool.
Yeah, Sonic is good.
Yeah, I think that Fortress America is a little bit too dry to be the hip hedgehog. But anyway.
All right. So these were meant to be somewhat fast, so that we don't get too bogged down in.
Yeah, we're about to get to
the last one.
Well, the last one's big. So there's a whole bunch of stuff here that's mentioned by TC. So I'll cover the general points. But so for art to be real, it has to show some sort of historical progression. It has to get better or evolve over time and wear its inspiration on its sleeve. Is there a difference between a game like Love Letter and a game like Hearts? And I think we have addressed that yes, there is a big difference, because Love Letter is the absolute progression of somebody's heart and soul of their design, whereas Hearts is something that evolved, who knows? It was just something that kind of came about from trick-taking games, and it's one of those that has evolved over time, like variations on poker.
Does Love Letter have more depth than Hearts? Is it more expressive?
I think it's more expressive, yes, because Hearts, in my opinion, is more like what you mentioned before, a parlor game, whereas the players bring their own emotional response to that game. It's a structure. It's a structure that most people know, and so it's just a basic rule set they sit down. And you can play with... The thing about Hearts is it plays with any standard deck of cards, and that deck of cards sure could be an expression of art, but itself, the design itself, is the people you play with. And mm-hmm. I think that's kind of what brings it down into its basic art forms. The other question we had here is Magic still the gold standard in card games? What have we learned or changed since then?
Yes, it is, and not a whole hell of a lot.
Yes, I agree. We're moving on. Okay, so Susan Jacoby, she had penned The Age of American Unreason. One of the main points is that the prevalence of video over print has erased a culture of effort. So do we feel that board games are the answer to this? And do the new board game app hybrids take away from this, or should board games stay pure? In other words, completely analog.
Yeah, pure.
Keep them pure. I would argue against that simply because of Mansions of Madness, because it is, honestly, it feels like an art piece.
But wouldn't you rather consult a chart that you would then have to
my result
find
chart?
The page in the book?
Oh, sure. I missed those.
I'd also, instead of Mansions of Madness is good, but another one is One Night Ultimate Werewolf. The film brings in an atmosphere to it.
I was about to say, where did that come from? But I forgot it has an app. Well, you could just record crickets chirping and you get the same thing.
But no, I mean, it tells you. It dictates through the turn and everything.
It's true. I guess it does. Yeah. It does guide the parlor game, so to speak. So it's like having an actual person there. And as we continue as a society, we're going to be encountering this more and more, because we're going to have apps that have AI. We're going to have artificial intelligences that do things for us. I'm not going to mention her name because she'll turn on, but my Echo here, when I say her name, like, she does all kinds of stuff for me, and it's going to be...
What's her name? I want to hear... Oh, she gets a cameo. Say it.
She gets a cameo? Hey, Alexa. Yeah. What is the temperature?
In Chapel Hill, it's 71 degrees with clear skies. Tonight, you can look for just a few clouds in the sky.
Nice.
Thank you. That's my girlfriend. So anyway.
And that's that is part of art here.
It is.
That is part of the discussion. So we have completely erased a culture of effort.
We have. You're right. We have completely erased. Because
Hasbro put out the that Monopoly game that had the tower, that the entire game was already dictated before you start.
Oh yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
Everything's done. And, like, what's the point to even play at that point?
You got to move the pieces. It's a robot telling you what to do.
it's flipping it. It's the robot is playing you, and you're playing the part of the robot that version of Monopoly.
I think that we're at the cusp of society right now, where board games are basically the whole plot line for WALL-E. It's like we have done nothing but automate society so much that our bones don't even connect anymore. Now, finally, board games allow us to actually move our joints again and do something analog. I don't necessarily mind the encroachment a little bit of digital, but I think that to be pure in its form, analog should be the way to go because it allows us to unplug.
Mm-hmm. I think you are pretty much right. I think like the idea of this, you know, I disagree with the point there that, like, you know, it's like culture of effort means that no art can be created, right? Like, effort does not necessarily equal art, good art, right? Like, that it could be bad art and you put a lot of work into it, right? Like, that's not the barometer. It's really, and we never got into it, but we'll get into it for the final question. I think board games do help with that, honestly. I think board games, they require a measure of effort that video games don't give you or other game forms don't give you. And I think you're rewarded for that. And that, I think, can be part of the art form going forward. And if you take all of that away, then you lose something. So I think we'll always see that, even though games can get easier to learn, I think we'll always see that as part of it. So, yeah.
I agree. I think so, too. All right, so we're rolling into the final big question right now because we're about almost at the two-hour mark and Jessica's going to kill us. But art is entirely subjective, but good or great art is remembered and lauded not just initially, but as people with high levels of taste look back on it later. So we have Monopoly, Scrabble, Clue, Trivial Pursuit. No matter what people say, these are not good examples of games that should be revered by those with high levels of taste. Now, we might have some disagreements on that, but that's okay. But in Roger Ebert's wording, what game is currently, quote, worthy of comparison with the great filmmakers, novelists, and poets? Or are there none? So, TC, what do you think?
So the whole thing about that was that there was, like, that Roger Ebert, and this is me reading the thingy, the whole thing about, like, Roger Ebert saying that was that the reason why board games can't be art is because they'll never be compared
to the great works.
To the great works. Yeah. And that his definition of art is that you have it's an expression of one person. It is presented in a way that someone will appreciate it and from a new angle, right? So even found art is art if it's presented in the correct way, right? Like if you find an old pipe and you put it on a wall, well, depending on how you present it, it may become art. And then people with high levels of taste. And I don't know how that works, right? Like who has the high level of taste, but we have things like Citizen Kane that you can look back at and say, well, people with high levels of taste look back at Citizen Kane as a, like, monumental film landmark.
An art piece, yes.
Yeah. And while I don't necessarily think that every game that comes out is an art piece, and the game that I'm going to pick is not an art piece in itself, I think we will consistently look back at it as a, like, landmark title that I don't think that's ever going to go away. I think it's almost, to me, it's almost like the perfect game, but is it art? Puerto Rico is my favorite game, and it's my favorite game for a reason, and that's why I picked it as one of those things that people will look back on 100 years from now, and they will still remember that game. There will be other games that come along, and for sure, there are people out there that are going to say, okay, well, games that are up on the top 10 list right now on Board Game Geek will probably be remembered. But there is something about a game that exemplifies everything that games were trying to achieve. And I think it's really hard because I always chase Puerto Rico with my game designs. And I don't think I'll ever hit it, but I think I can provide something different for people. Something like completely different from Puerto Rico to make it so that there is, like, while I would say Puerto Rico is kind of like not a, like a James Joyce novel, Puerto Rico is more like, I don't even know what to call it. More like, that's what I'm thinking. It's more like a Moby Dick.
It's a Herman Melville.
It's a Melville. It's like, it is the standard traditional look at everything that we've had and put it together in a way that just flows. And I think
it's a definition of an age.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go. And I think there'll be art that comes out after it that there'll be better and will even be more encompassing of what the creator is trying to express. But that one, it'll always stick with me. And I think it'll always stick with a lot of players, and I think it'll be surprise people for a long time.
All right. So I'll buy that for a dollar.
It's no James Joyce novel, which I'll do the James Joyce novel of board gaming, so people can go, oh, well, of course, games are art now.
Yeah, my choice is more of a Robert Frost, so I'm going more the poetry route because it's a little shorter, and it is East Palm.
Two roads diverged.
In a wood, and I chose the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. And that's the same thing with East Palm because... it's not as well known as some of the others, but I'm going to champion that, and I chose the path less traveled.
With camels on it.
With camels, right, exactly. But it's a little bit more relatable to poetry because it has a rhythm to it. The entire game has a rhythm, it has a cadence. All the components work together to make it enhance the gameplay. It's immersive. It lasts exactly the amount of time you really want it to for the type of gameplay that it is. I know I've mentioned it several times, but it is a super elegant game. It all comes together in my mind to create an art piece and a modern piece of art that some may not remember simply because of its it being lost in the seas of Ticket to Rides and Monopolies and things like that. But for those that have or want to acquire a higher taste, this type of game is what they're looking for. It also becomes, even though we've mentioned it 1,000 times, a slightly hipster choice because, again, it's one of those that's not quite as well known. But if you would like to take the path less traveled, you will choose East Behind. All right, Daryl, what you got?
Okay. There was one that I thought of while going over this podcast. I'll mention that at the end, but the one initial one is Stone Age. And that's because it defined a genre. Like, it defined worker placement. Like, if you're ever going to play a worker placement game, this is, like, the most elegant worker placement game out there. It's the most popular. It's always going to be around. And people are going to talk about it as, hey, that's what defined what worker placement was. That's what made worker placement fun. And so Stone Age is definitely that. The other one that I thought of while going through all of this, and it kind of brings up the whole part that the game is art, is Carcassonne. I'm not a huge fan of Carcassonne, but the fact that it's an art piece that the players themselves are physically building and changing every single time, it's kind of like a modern art piece, really. It's very interactive, and so that was the other one. But mainly Stone Age.
All right, I agree with that. I'm also looking at a game in front of me right now that's on my A-team shelf, my subset A-team shelf, which is the space games. And it's a game that exists as an art piece because I don't think anyone's ever actually played it, but it's Android from Fantasy Flight.
Oh, yeah, well, you know what? An interesting side note to that. I had it on my list that we never got to it because we changed the question. But it was Android is my bad game that's art.
It is totally an art piece. It is completely an art piece.
It is way art. It does. It tries to do so many things that are off the wall and crazy, and fails at like at least 95% of them. But man, just the experience of sitting down, learning the game, playing it for a few, well, for a few hours, maybe 4 or 5 hours, and being halfway through the game is something I'll remember forever. I hated the game, but the fact that one guy was piecing together parts of his psyche up on the top with like puzzle pieces while the other person was down investigating a murder down on like the earth, while the other person was up in the moon doing this what were all those things? Like trying to get rid of the emotional baggage that they have from their right. current divorce.
Right, exactly.
And like, I'm down there in a car, I just got a vehicle and I'm like doing this. Like, it's just, what is going, like, there's no, like, who knows what's going on in this game, because it's trying to go in every single direction. And somehow that just creates this like warm feeling of like goodness in my heart, right? Like, and it's just this.
Well, it's
art,
like life. It's like everybody's doing something different, and nobody knows what the hell is going on.
It's just, yeah, and there's no point to it. Like, you get to the end, and you're just like, oh, that's how that resolves. I literally could care less at this point. And you won with 15 points. Like 15, you can win that game with like 8 points. It makes no sense, and there's the point of playing that game is not to win, because I don't know how you orchestrate a win, because somebody can just play a card on you that does bad stuff to you all of a sudden and like ruin everything. It's just so, it is so scattershot, but yeah, that is just art. That is some crazed mind there.
It's a vanity project of the highest order, and it is crazy that it exists. I still, to this day, have tried to get it to the table about 1,000 times. Nobody wants to play it, which is sad, because I so want to experience Android, but it's been sitting on my shelf forever. And I'm like, oh, but it is definitely an art piece. I've gotten all the pieces out, I've read through the rules, and I'm like, this makes no sense. But it just exists for the sake of existing.
Well, I want to thank everybody for indulging me a little bit on this art thing. You know, and I'm actually sad that we didn't come up with some crazy, like, really worthy of comparison, great filmmakers, novelists, and poets kind of thing, but like, you could just point to and go, look at that crazy thing. Like, I think what we picked were very safe. Like, we all picked, like, good games that are safe, and they do what they're supposed to do. They may not be, like, they're art to me, because they like they really have a purpose and express themselves really well, but like at the same time I don't think they express a feeling so much as just exemplify our the hobby and what it's trying to do.
Yeah, maybe. Well, what,
I don't know.
How about Letters from
Whitechapel? So maybe we're still waiting a little. Oh, well, yeah, Letters from Whitechapel is pretty good. But like,
yeah.
But I was like, but just as at the end here, I was just like, I felt like Roger Ebert sometimes, like even while we were picking things, sometimes I feel like he's right. I don't know, like sometimes board games completely alienate me. Sometimes video games too, like especially video games, because they like they do like 99% retreading and then just one cool thing and new game. Right. And they might take 5 years as a huge, like 100 people working on this thing, game for 5 years, and then they come out with this game and it's like, do you like first person shooters? This first person shooter is in space, but also it's I don't know. It's you have a ship and everyone's on a ship together. Great. OK, that's a new game. So
derivatives.
Yeah. Derivatives of things. And like, and even on Board Game Geek, like when I first started looking at Board Game Geek, and I feel like a hipster now, but like when I looked at Board Game Geek before, it used to be just all these like weird things that I was like, oh, these are magical. Like, I've never heard of these things. Like, they're just like there's D-Mocker in the 12 position. There's like Power Grid and like all these weird games I'd never heard of. And now it's just like, oh, the new Star Wars game is number 5. Android Netrunner is number 6. Like, those aren't they don't, like, the people with high levels of taste don't push the genre forward. Like, we'll just continue, like, as the hobby gets more popular, we'll start seeing more of these types of games taking over, and I hate it. And I feel, like, really discouraged that maybe we're not actually moving towards art.
Yep. Mm-hmm. I hear everything you're saying. I think that there can be, I think we've come up with examples of things that can be art that are board games. Definitely some examples of things that can't or are not art. But of course, everyone out there is going to have their own opinions because art is subjective. So if you
want
to chime
art.
In, yeah, make some art.
Make some art. Buddy.
If you want to chime in about this, or perhaps you have some better examples of art pieces or something that is definitely not art, definitely hit us up on Twitter. And of course, you can always email thestateofgames@gmail.com, as well as go to dicehateme.com and comment on the podcast there, or go join our guild on BGG and let us know your thoughts. That is Guild 1903. We're going to wrap this up. We're going to head into the backside of the podcast, but there is an art piece that's going to be mentioned, so don't go away. All right, so let's get on to our notable Kickstarters. I'm going to go in reverse order because I want to follow up the art angle in this. I don't know who added this. Probably TC. It's the Fidget Cube.
Oh, no, that wasn't me.
That wasn't you?
Okay. Who added that?
Thing is totally an art piece.
Maybe I did add that.
I think you added that. But the Fidget Cube is...
I added that.
Did you?
Oh, okay.
I'm backing it.
Okay, this is where I find that the art is signaling the doom of humanity as a whole, because this thing exists for no other reason than to fidget with it. I think it's fascinating. I think it's awesome, but at the same time, it has made $3.5 million.
Oh wow, it's at $3.5 million now?
Yes, and there's 36 days to go.
When I looked at it, it was like $20,000.
This thing that is literally going to retail for $24, that all you do is fidget with it, is going to probably by the end make $10 million on Kickstarter. I want to shoot myself in the head right now.
That is amazing. How did it get to that point? That went crazy viral.
It's nuts. It's everywhere. People talking about it everywhere. And all you do is do just nothing with it. You just sit there at your desk and you can they break it down for you here. How do I use the
six-sided cube?
You can click on these faces that look like a die, but you're just clicking little buttons and it makes a satisfying little click sound. But there's also two silence buttons that don't click, so when you click those, they're different. And then you can glide, so it's like a little analog joystick. And I'm like, well, why don't you just grab your analog joystick or the console that you own at home? But you can't do that at your desk, so you got your little joystick. Then you can flip. Why don't you just flip the light switch? But your coworkers will get annoyed at you if you flip the light switch off and on. But if you sit at your desk flipping this back and forth on the fidget cube, you'll be satiated. Then there's the little worry button where you're like rubbing on a worry stone. Then you got roll, where it's like, you know, trying to unlock like a particular, like, you know, three-digit lock, you know, that has a code on it. And then you have another little rolly button thing, so it's like your trackball. And then finally you have spin. So it's like the old iTunes or iPads, where you would just spin to get to whatever you want. You know, that was pretty satisfying too. But there's six faces of this thing. It looks like a die from a schizophrenic.
Yep.
And it has made, let me just reiterate, $3.5 million.
And it's
36
awesome.
Days to go.
It's pretty cool. I'm surprised it's made that much money, but like, yeah, it's pretty cool. When I saw it, I was like, oh, do I want to back that? I don't know.
The initial funding goal, by the way, $15,000.
Yeah.
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 And it's nothing but
I'm getting out of the board game industry.
I'm totally leaving the board game industry. I'm just going to like come up with the weirdest crap that I could ever think of, and I'm going to put them on Kickstarter, and one of them will stick. Because between potato salad and this thing, I'm like, are you kidding me? Although this thing's cool, at least you can do something with this thing. But I'm like, it does the same thing that everything else you could find does.
Yep,
but all of these,
this is
in one.
TC, this game exemplifies why you need to make that cube game.
Yes, we need to make your red cube game.
Okay, well there you go. So let's do that.
And we'll make $3.5 million off of it. That would be amazing. Then we can retire and move to Aruba or something. Jeez. Anyway.
All right, I need a group of 100 children. Stat. For my Kickstarter video.
Well, I mean, I have access to a few, and Daryl has access to 2 of them, so. But I already have a pen. Do I really need Fidget Cube? So it even has a graphic here.
I already have a pen.
That shows you how the Fidget Cube breaks down in what it does versus a pen, a pencil, a worry stone, a key ring, and ice cubes.
That's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Ice cubes. Who plays with ice cubes?
Because it feels cool in your hand. Ice cubes feel cool in your hand. That's actually funny because I love the tongue-in-cheek of this. The whole point that this thing exists is an affront to humanity, but I love it. And I hate it at the same time. It's really eliciting a huge emotional response in me, and that's why it's a piece of art. Because
the project is art. The actual thing is you know, applied art.
Well, I'm in for 5 fidget cubes.
No. Hey, are you serious?
I'm dead serious.
Okay, I can say this, though. They took way too much time thinking about it, and that's awesome.
Like, they did. They have a timeline here.
It's not like they picked it up and one day went, maybe I'll just make this thing and put it up on Kickstarter. They were like, we went through like 75 different iterations of this thing.
It's true. It's 4 years of incubating the idea for this before they launch it on Kickstarter.
Yeah. That's awesome.
It's freaking nuts.
And they deserve it.
I suppose.
I will say the little 3 dials on the one side, I wish they had numbers on them.
Well, ooh,
You should comment.
I wish it was a lock combination.
That actual lock. And when they do unlock it, the Fidget Cube opens. And there's something inside.
That you can fidget with.
All right, so we're going to move on. But once again, I will say $3.5 million.
Yes.
Okay, so let's talk about something that's not making $3.5 million, but it's still worth your time to check out on Kickstarter, and that is Pentaquark. That is by Buttonshy Games, but it's by our friend Mike Mullins, who is the solo player Rain Man, so to speak. But Pentaquark is an awesome little game that you should check out, especially if you like playing solo player. It's one of those designs that's fairly elegant, and it only has, how many cards does it have? 18, yeah. So, again, it fits into the little flappy, whatever you call those things, envelopes or billfolds or whatever. Jason's
wallet size.
Yeah, wallet size. So it flips in on itself. There's only 4 days to go as of the recording this podcast. So by the time this podcast comes out, it'll probably only be like 1 or 2 days left. So jump on this project right now.
Regrettably, this is the first wallet game that I have backed. But
is it really?
But I did back it.
Oh, there you go. I backed Cow Tiger Santa Claus. And I'll probably after we finish recording. But free U.S. shipping, and it's only $10. You can't beat that, especially if you're a solitaire player. I think you'll really enjoy
it. Get on it soon, because the podcast will be posted really quickly nearby the time it'll end.
Yes,
so.
Exactly. So jump on it as immediately as you can. Does anybody else have any other Kickstarters they want to mention? Nope.
Yeah.
All right. So Dice Hate Me Games news. We mentioned in the last podcast that we were going to launch Isle of Trains, All Aboard, on September, I believe I said it was the 6th. We decided not to do that for 2 reasons, and we have to do that sometimes to make sure that we're giving enough due diligence to a project. One is that we didn't quite have the video completely ready because Seth and Dan just haven't had time to really record anything, and the second is because we're still working with Daniel Gadara on the final pieces of art, so we want to get all that done so the presentation looks nice. We have every intent of making this a reality, and also we'll probably have a pretty low funding goal on this. So Isle of Trains, of course, has been well received. It's a great game, and this adds passengers. You can now truck passengers around, and they want to be delivered to certain areas, so you can do that. So there's more train cars, passenger cars. There's also passenger locomotives. And incentives, and also new buildings that can actually help you out depending on how many passengers you've done. So there's more avenues to victory. There will actually be a board with the game, so we're going to produce it probably in our Chunky Monkey style box, which is introduced by Bottom of the Ninth Clubhouse edition. And you don't have to worry about it. If you own the regular Isle of Trains, you can put it right inside that box. You have plenty of rooms for other expansions we might introduce in the future. And if you don't own Isle of Trains, and why don't you? Then you can also pick up a copy of Isle of Trains with this campaign. So we'll have more more information throughout this month and also in October about when we might be launching that. We're probably going to launch it around the 1st of November for a pretty short campaign, probably a couple weeks. So keep your ears open for that.
Instaback.
Instaback. That's right, because it's an awesome game, and it's going to be even awesomer with the All Aboard expansion. I'll personally be at Grand Con this week. As of the dropping of this podcast, probably only a day or two until I'm actually there, but I'll be in Grand Rapids, Michigan at Grand Con September the 16th through the 18th. So if you plan to be at that convention, hit me up. Say hello to me. Richard Launius will be there as well, the designer of co-designer of Fate of the Elder Gods and, of course, everything else that's cool in the world. He's a really cool guy, so if you want to hang out and talk to him, I'll be on a couple of panels, but also have a couple of Play for Charity events going on there at Grand Con. But just come on up, say hey, or we can try to get a game in together. And I'm also going to announce, not necessarily from Dice Hit Me Games, but of course from Greater Than Games, under our Fabled Nexus imprint is Laser Riders, which is coming up at the beginning of October, and it is super awesome. It's basically Tron, the Light Cycle game. So hopefully I don't breach any trademark things with that.
But better.
But better.
But better.
Better. Right, exactly. It's totally
you
80s.
Meant Tren. The light motor.
Right. The light bike game. But it's similar to that, but it's all using directional bendy pieces and things like that to negotiate around a track over the open board, the table, and try to get through these goals while avoiding everybody else's line. It's super fun, super easy to play. It's a blast. It's totally 80s. It's going to be so rad. I can't wait to see what Anthony and Nicole do for the video. And we'll have all that, a little bit more information on that in the next podcast. So, unpub news, Daryl.
It's there.
You knew it was coming up.
We have sponsorship information available now for Unpub 7, so if you're interested, please let us know. We started sending things out today. In addition to that, the promised Unpub brand new website will be coming in October. So we've got the front end done. We're now working on the back end. We don't want to push the front end because it doesn't work with the back end of the old one, so we're rebuilding the back end to work with the new front end, and then it's all done. So that'll definitely be coming in October, and all the tables for Unpub 7 have sold out. There is a waiting list still available, so if you go to that link at Eventbrite, you can jump on and join the waiting list right in there. It's automated. It's really nice. And also the VIP playtesters, registered playtester tickets are also on sale. So grab them now. Be special. Be awesome. And join us.
There you go.
Mm-hmm. It's worth it.
It is totally worth it. So definitely do that. And the final bit of business we need to take care of is our selfie contest that we announced.
I have issues with this.
I'm sorry.
Issues.
Hold on. Just cool your jets. Okay,
no.
So there were certain parameters. There were certain parameters that had to be done in order for this to be a true contest. And I understand your issues, Daryl, because according to our rules for the selfie contest, it had to be linked to the State of Games on Twitter. And apparently a lot of people who like TC listen to the rules. So TC had 9 selfies that were linked to the State of Games on Twitter. Jessica had 4, I had 1, and Daryl had 0. Now, what Daryl's bitching about is the fact that he had selfies posted to Get Louder, which were 6. I had 18 selfies posted to Dice Hate Me, but they were not linked to the State of Games account on Twitter, which were part of the rules. And unfortunately,
I'm going to go back and listen to that episode because I do not recall that as part of the rules.
They were
part of the rules. I knew the rules, apparently.
You know, TC's did it to a lot of people. So I think empirically our evidence here shows that people were listening to the rules themselves, because with 9 selfies linked to the State of Games for TC, that's a lot.
Well, I still call shenanigans because Jessica was not at Gen Con.
Apparently she was there 4 times. You were there 0. So,
yep, you were the ghost.
Easy to see.
That's right. So, basically what we have determined is, according to our rules, the person who had the fewest selfies, thank God I had the 1 that was linked to the State of Games. But Daryl had 0. I thought I was going to win outright, but they were all linked to me because everybody knows that to link me with Dice Hate Me. But anyway, that's beside the point. But Daryl has the fewest amount, and according to our rules, he's supposed to do something We don't know yet. So what we're asking all of you out there in podcast land, all you listeners, you get to decide what ideas you would like to punish Daryl. Now, I think that we can probably take away not be on the podcast anymore because he's rarely here. So we're going to have
yeah, come on. That's a good thing.
So we're going to have some other, and I will just throw out hints there that Halloween's coming up. So whatever ideas you have, send it to us, tweet at the State of Games on Twitter. Or either any of us on Twitter, if you'd like to send an email to thestateofgames@gmail.com, post on the guild or post on dicehateme.com. Let us know your ideas. And then the next podcast, we'll talk about those ideas and everybody can vote on those in the guild. And then we can, we'll decide what Daryl has to do, what nastiness he has to do for himself. We'll probably discount like shave his head and stuff like that, but there are some creative ideas you can have without destroying his head of hair or his facial hair or whatever.
But, helmet full of spiders.
Helmet full of spiders. Oh, that's a good one. Oh yeah. What's your biggest fear, Daryl? I'm gonna ask Leslie.
We need you to face your fear.
That's right. We're gonna do Fear Factor.
Yeah, Fear Factor Daryl edition.
Honestly, I think my biggest phobia is messing with electric.
Oh, we can. Oh, I got an idea already. Nipple clamps.
When I was a kid, it used to be spiders, but I've kind of outgrown that. It doesn't bother me much.
All right. Well, so. We'll get a car battery out and light
oh,
it up.
Oh God.
Don't throw me in the briar patch. All right, so that's it for this episode of State of Games. Thank you all for indulging us in our crazy, subjective, esoteric conversation about art as board games. But we'll be back next time with more great board game discussion. Of course, we want to hear from you, and we want to provide content that you want to hear. So please send us ideas for show topics you'd like for us to cover and new segments you'd like to hear. We've mentioned throughout the podcast that you can email things. Who put that on there?
Darn it, you didn't say it.
Of course I didn't
say it. You're supposed to read every word of the podcast that I wrote.
All right. For behind the scenes for everybody, they put in the notes here. You can email
them. No, don't they that. Don't they that.
They. Who was it?
No. TC? Not me.
Now, whoever put it in, so you can email pics of your boobs to thestateofgames@gmail.com. This is a family podcast, people. Come on. You can email us your ideas and things you would like for us to hear at thestateofgames@gmail.com, and you can tweet us at thestateofgames. You can also go to dicehateme.com and comment on the podcast, or join Guild 1903 on boardgamegeek.com. You can also hit me up on Twitter at dicehateme. What about the rest of you bastards?
You can find me on I totally did not write that on Twitter at getlouder.
Yeah, well, I totally wrote it. And I was hoping you would actually say it out loud. But anyway, so disappointed. The whole podcast wasted. I'm at Puppy Shogun. I also do a segment called Deep Design on the Perfect Information podcast. And it's usually about 30 minutes into the podcast where I come in and I class it up with some game design advice. And lately I've been doing real rules explanations, rules writing, so
yeah,
we'll see.
You berate people about rules and what they should do, so that's
well, awesome. I do, but at the same time I'm terrible at it, so learn from me.
All right, well, until next time, this is Dice Hate Me.
This is Get Louder.
This is Puppy Shogun
saying thanks for listening, and may all your rolls be sixes. Oh yeah, pics of boobs.
Guys have boobs.
That's true. Guys do have boobs. So do cats.
3rd Jessica here again. I'd just like to start these bloopers off by saying that my co-hosts are gross.
All right, I'm recording our backup here. Let's everybody get our machines recording, and then we can do our clap thing.
Right. Sure, this is good.
Stretch here, stretch on. Crack my neck.
I am live. Oh, nice.
Yep, get it all
beautiful.
Out.
Oh, man, that's right at the beginning of the... That's going to be awesome. That's right at the beginning of the recording.
Yeah.
We just put that right at the end, after the sign-off.
Perfect.
Burp fart.
Here we go. 3, 2, 1. Close enough. Jessica will just have to deal.
Those jerks. Well, there's only one more gross blooper to be had. And trust me, there were plenty more that I could have tacked on here, but I was getting sick to my stomach listening to them. So I did not want to subject you all to that.
All right. Is everybody ready to go?
Yep. Do I think so. Yeah.
Okay. That's fantastic. This is the boys' club tonight. It's like super weird.